Hello and welcome to the latest edition of The Savage Beast. I'm Dan White, a.k.a. The Beast Must Die, and I'm here with Matt Colgate, a.k.a. Lord Nuneaton Savage.
Hello.
And the high concept of this episode is we are going to talk about Stephen King movies, but we're going to talk about the, what was it you described it as? The Path Less Trodden.
Yes.
The terrible Stephen King adaptations, and there are many, many, many to choose
we're
from.
We're not scraping the bottom of the barrel. We're around the sort of like we're about sort of like a third of the way up the barrel, just pulling the barnacles
off. There's still worse that could be
dragged
out.
My God, are there worse that could be dragged out?
And this is not, you know, when we say terrible, this is not to say there aren't pleasures to be had, but I think, you know, anyone who knows the kind of the sheer morass of Stephen King adaptations out there, there are the usual suspects that get talked about. You know, people are endlessly ranking them, you know, what's the best, which are the kind of good ones. And actually, we wanted to spend a bit of time with the ones that no one ranks as particularly the highest.
Yeah.
And in fact, some of them are ranked among some of the worst.
I would have definitely agreed, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. It's like, I don't need to hear or read another article about The Shining. I know everything about that film now, almost just by osmosis.
Yeah.
You know, I could probably never have seen that film, and I'd probably know everything about it without having to see it.
Yeah.
So it's just a little bit of a deeper dive into some of the less classy delights from the oeuvre, shall we say.
And I think it's important with someone like Stephen King, who is, you know, the probably the most important, you know, popular horror creator of the last, I don't know, 50 years.
Yeah.
He's a huge phenomenon. I mean, he has the kind of success that will not be replicated, partly because of when he kind of came up, the era of the airport novel, when paperbacks were actually, you know, were sold everywhere, and, you know, to have a hit was to be, you know, to sell astonishing amounts. But also just because he arrived on the back of a number of other voices and sort of crystallized a particular, I guess, kind of boomer voice of horror.
Very much so, yeah.
And he, you know, he is someone who has produced an awful lot of work. He has produced, I'd say, one or two books a year for the majority of his writing career.
Good Lord, yeah.
And there are so many of the fuckers, so it's no wonder that they get adapted frequently, because, you know, you have had ones that are tremendous successes, iconic films and huge blockbuster hits. So and it's a ready-made source of kind of inspiration for films. So you can see that, obviously, Hollywood, TV, all sorts of things have gone back to the well again.
And he's tremendously generous with his work as well, isn't he? You know, he famously didn't he say that everyone could buy the rights to one of his short stories for a dollar, one of his dollar babies. And he's very generous
with
letting people use their vision, you know, implant their vision in his work,
hats off
to the guy. That's a very cool thing to do.
He's so fucking rich that he really can afford to not worry about it. And so he is generous with that. And he has a sort of
he's not Alan Moore.
No, and he has a healthy sort of combative relationship with his adaptations. He's not afraid to call them out. Obviously, notoriously, the aforementioned Shining. But, you know, if you can find his opinions on most of the adaptations, and it's always interesting to hear which ones he rates, which ones he likes, because again, like the films we're going to talk about tonight, there are pleasures to be had in the shittier end of the spectrum, really, and sometimes that shittiness is inherent in Stephen King.
Right.
He's a complicated writer in that he is capable of extremely good writing and very compelling writing and really dumb, shitty ideas, often on the same page. And he's a horror writer who doesn't deal in classy shocks. He likes the sort of trashier end, but not fully. We're not talking Richard Layman, Dean Koontz. He's sort of still elevated above them, but, you know, his stuff is often quite stupid in its own way.
You get the sense with him a lot of the time that he's never met an idea that he hasn't been able to turn into a horror book.
Yeah.
Which would perhaps explain why he's been so extraordinarily prolific.
Yes.
You know, you get the feeling that he basically looks at a chair and goes, what would happen if that chair ate people?
Yeah, and I mean, you can track down interviews where he pretty much says, I literally was waiting in an airport, I looked over, I saw this happening, and I thought, how would it be if that chair ate people? I mean, pretty much as kind of basic as that, and he will spin out a 400-page novella out of that.
While at the airport.
Yeah, exactly. And it will be
in the airport spinner rack before he's actually left the airport.
He might talk about editors, but I think that they're more of a notion than a reality, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, these editors called Kevin Sting, and no one's met him. Because this is the thing, we should probably point out before we get started, we are both coming from very different approaches here, because you are a King fan, aren't you?
Yeah, I sort of had the traditional induction into him, you know, at the appropriate age, where I was kind of sneaking looks at my cousin's copies of the books, reading the gory bits, finding the sexy bits.
Yeah.
And then I kind of graduated to actually sort of reading them and feeling incredibly proud of myself for reading these 400-page monstrosities. And so I, at the right point, I was a real sort of fan. I mean, I was never 100% there, but I was a big fan. He was an important writer to me, and a couple of books, you know, remain incredibly important to me. And I sort of have drifted away as my taste has developed and my, you know. So I'm definitely, you know, in King's camp, as it were, whereas you...
I've never read any Stephen King. I know that now I've said that, pretty much everyone listening to this podcast has now turned off.
Yeah.
So I probably should have saved that revelation till the end. Yes. I didn't come at horror from a horror background.
Yeah.
I came at horror from, this is going to sound unbelievably Ponzi, I came at horror from an avant-garde literary background.
Yeah.
So I came to horror through H.P. Lovecraft and through... people like William Burroughs, and through the sort of the horror anthologies and the Lovecraft-based anthologies that you got, that Creation Books and people like that used to put out.
Yeah.
So I come at it from a more sort of, I mean, Lovecraft's not European, but a more sort of European avant-garde sort of approach. So as a result, because, I mean, the word that you're looking for is snob, because Stephen King was very popular... Yeah. I wasn't going to read him.
Yeah, yeah. It's...
And I've kept that up. I'm quite impressed with that. I actually took Firestarter on holiday. Now, this is it. This was the gods telling me I was on the right track. I took Firestarter with me on holiday to where my dad lives in Lanzarote, which is like a town with absolutely no culture whatsoever.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, well, this is the time to start reading
hot
the
weather,
King.
Yeah,
yeah, hot weather,
lazy times.
Like, there's one secondhand bookshop in this town, which is obviously where all the expats go and swap their books. And I went in there thinking, I'm not going to find anything, but I'll have a look. And I instantly found a Grady Hendrix novel and a Paul Tremblay novel. So it was like, right, okay, Stephen King's going in the back of the car then. So yeah. I'll just read this sort of slightly more interesting stuff. So yeah, I've actually never read any Stephen King. I think I might have read a couple of the short stories in some anthologies.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But so as a result, that does make me something of a pariah in the horror community.
Yes, you are. You would not be allowed on certain American podcasts,
no,
that's for sure.
They would set me on fire.
I think it's that's a good thing, though. I think it's a good thing because it means you can take the films as they are as well, and that's what we should be doing. I mean, I definitely had a moment where I sort of came back to King out of a guilty pleasure, sort of like, I fancy seeing... You know, I deconstructed them and found all the faults in his writing and all the ticks and all the, you know, tropes. And so I started to be like, oh, yes, that's bad writing. And now I'm into high literature. I don't read that anymore. And then as you kind of age and you stop being so hard on your younger self, you kind of go back. And I had a sort of rekindling. And I found actually that I do love on holiday to take a Stephen King. So something reliably readable and... page turnery about those things, and if I'm on holiday, I just want that kind of switch your brain off, tell me a story stuff a lot of the time. But what's interesting about that is that reading them as you're older, you sort of go, he's such a weird writer, he's such an odd writer, because he is like he's always talked about as a master storyteller, as a kind of and a real kind of understanding of character in his writing and stuff like that, and yet. You will read these things, and the plots just go sailing over the horizon so quickly.
Yeah,
he is absolutely incapable of just retaining any sort of control. In his earlier books, he did, but now, I mean, it's like anything goes. And so it's kind of, he's a fascinating person to have been so successful, because they're so weird, some of those fucking books.
Well, I think it's the thing that everyone sort of comes back to is that is, I think you just said it, is that kind of warmth that he has with his characters. And I think, you know, to talk about myself again for a little bit, that's kind of what puts me off a little bit, because I don't go to horror for warmth. Like I said, I come from the H.P. Lovecraft perspective. I go to horror so I can feel profoundly alienated and upset.
And I think, bar a few notable exceptions, largely you are going to get the kind of warm bath feeling where you spend so much time with these characters, you really begin to feel quite intimately connected to them. With all, you know, I mean, it is, he's so guilty of going, who's your main character? He's a writer. He's very handsome. He used to have a problem with alcohol. He doesn't anymore. He always puts...
Kevin Sting looked at his grizzled face.
His grizzled, handsome face.
Because he looks a bit like a shaved Wookiee.
He does. But, you know, you do get this kind of warm bath thing. And no, you don't get the kind of alienating cold horror. Yeah. There are a couple of his books where...
So I gather. I should read those.
And what's interesting about him is that the psychological tumult that he was going through, because he was, you know, a struggling writer. This is well-trodden territory. But, you know, he got married early. He had kids early. He had to write to sort of save his family, because it was that or get a shit job somewhere. And that was, so he, you know, much like Alan Moore, he sort of out of necessity wrote. And
it's an American success story, don't he wrote himself out of poverty.
And then he was not just successful, but enormously successful. And in a matter of years went from, you know, nothing to astonishing success. And lo and behold, developed a huge drug and alcohol problem. So much so that some of his kind of key works were written in a complete narcotic haze.
And one of his key works was directed in a narcotic haze. We'll be coming to that later.
We will be getting to that, yeah. And so you kind of go on this psychological journey with him in these books. And that's where it can get really interesting, actually. Mm. Before we go into the films, I will just give you a list of my five
favourites. Yes, I was going to ask, come on.
Stephen King books.
Should we get that kind of Top of the Pops music?
And this is in no real order. And again, I haven't read all of his books, so there will be ones where people are like, yeah, exactly. but I'll tell you the five I think that resonated with me. Obviously, first, you got to say It. Because anyone who, you know, likes King owes themselves reading that book, because it's the core text.
It's everyone's favourite, isn't it? I mean, it was when I interviewed Matt Holness, director of Possum, and former star of Garth Brooks' Dark Place.
Yes.
He was just like, and you know, I kept very quiet, but he was just kind of like, you don't have much business liking horror if you haven't read it. And
yeah.
I kept very quiet during that.
Yeah.
But he was like, in many ways, it is the ultimate horror novel. Mm. It's big.
It's the kitchen sink is in there.
But it's cosmic terror. It's localized white picket fence terror. Yeah. It's kind of everything all in one.
Yeah, it's got every single monster he can think of in this kind of shape changing, malevolent kind of. And an astonishing kind of creation in Pennywise the Clown, or, you know, that's one of the things it wears. But
he invented the scary clown, so
he really
did.
He fucking nailed it as well.
That's a pretty impressive trope to have under your hat.
But it is, you know, I read it when I was 15. It was a whole summer of my life.
Yeah.
It was a lovely hot summer. I spent much of it under a cover in my room reading it, like you do when you think back to your childhood and go, was I out riding my BMX like I thought I was? No, you were inside reading Stephen King.
I was inside playing on my Amstrad. My mum begged me to go and play in the garden.
And so, you know, it has that impact, and it's well trodden. I don't need to talk about it, but it's definitely in there. The second one I would rate incredibly highly is Cujo, which is a very tight, excellent novel from his early period when he was writing, you know, controlled, streamlined sort of books. And Cujo is a really great sustained bit of tension writing, with a really, like, his most bleak ending, and it's a tremendously effective book, and I really rate it as a kind of top-notch thriller. I mean it is a great, you know, and it doesn't have chapters, it's almost like a continuous piece. He apparently was so drunk he doesn't remember writing it, which is really interesting because it's by far and away one of his best pieces of writing.
That's hope for me. That's good news.
So get shit-faced and start writing.
I always do.
So Cujo, I rate that. Third one, he wrote as Richard Bachman for a while. He did this thing where, which I think is quite cool. He basically just wanted to see if he could still, you know, get success as a genre writer under a pseudonym. And for a while, it genuinely, you know, people didn't know. And there's a kind of nice literary sort of detective act where someone uncovered who he was.
It's interesting because his son did the same thing, didn't he? Joe Hill did the same thing. He didn't reveal who he was.
And within those, he wrote these kind of unashamed sort of pulpy throwback exploitation novels. And one of them in the Bachman books is The Running Man, which is, I read ages and ages ago. I haven't read since, but it's a kind of dystopian, it's very prescient. It's a kind of future game show. You know, we've all seen the film. The book is much more, doesn't have the kind of cartoonish quality. It's a lot more from that school of kind of late 70s, early 80s, high concept, tight thrillers.
You're saying that it doesn't have Sub-Zero in it?
It does not have Sub-Zero or anyone.
No Sub-Zero, no Mick Fleetwood, no Running Man as well.
No Mick Fleetwood, for fuck's sake. I mean, what the hell? But it's great, and it's got the single most claustrophobic and unpleasant bit of writing I've ever read, which is where the main character is, you know, trying to escape from a building that's on fire, goes down a kind of like a ventilation shaft, gets to the bottom, and realizes that he can't get out because the kind of, it's at a right angle, and he's kind of facing forward, and so where your feet are is where the shaft is. And the description of him trying to turn his body in as it's heating up and the flames coming down is just so fucking horrible. And I don't think I even could reread it, but I remember as a kid just literally my heart was in my mouth for the whole sequence. And that is one of the things he's really fucking good at. He puts you in the shoes of a character in a very horrible situation. He does it brilliantly. So Running Man's very good. That's three. Pet Sematary, number four.
Right, yep.
Pet Sematary is definitely his most unpleasant book. And
he almost didn't publish it, didn't he?
Yeah, his wife was like, no, that's horrid. And it, as a family man, he, you know, he's not afraid of, you know, for all of his kind of warm bath tendencies, he actually will go to the dark places.
He kills kids.
Yeah, and that one is all about losing a kid and what a parent would do who'd lost their kid. And as a parent, I don't know how I'd feel going back to Pet Sematary. I think I would struggle with it. But the book is fucking great, really unpleasant, really nasty, and extremely cold in its way. Made for a great adaptation. One of my favourite Stephen King's is Mary Lambert's 1989 Pet Sematary. I think it's a great, great, horrid horror story. And Pet Sematary is well worth a read, actually. That would be my top pick for you, I would say.
It sounds horrible.
The idea
childless, unlovable, cold man that I am.
Yeah, exactly. You'll love it.
Are you a sociopath?
Yeah. And then the final recommendation, and this is by most people's standards one of his worst books, The Tommyknockers, which is, again, written, took him about 6 years to write, at the absolute depths of his cocaine psychosis and addiction. And alcohol. He wrote this. He notoriously started writing it, got halfway through, had terrific writer's block, came back to it. And you can tell because literally the main characters you're introduced to disappear for legit 500 pages of the book. Wow. They are not seen while he... And Tommyknock is an alien invasion story. And it is all over the place. It is incredibly badly structured. The tempo is all over the place. But it is the most wonderful depiction of addiction. It's all about a town that becomes addicted to this kind of this weird alien technology and start fucking behaving awfully to each other. And not only is the writing like a form of sort of self, you know, he's self-flagellation about addiction, almost subconsciously.
Yeah.
But the actual writing about people being addicted is astonishing. And it really is amazing. It's about 1,200 pages long. It's one of his longest. It's bloated. He hates it. Lots of people think it's his worst. It's easily one of his best.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I remember the miniseries.
Yes, with
I can't remember who.
Jimmy Smits.
Jimmy Smits.
Who just sort of just
popped up in a lot of things.
Jimmy Smits was just always too smooth to play anyone like in the grip of addiction, really. But and that was one of the miniseries of which we're not, just to say, we're not dealing with the miniseries in this episode.
God, no. We were thinking about doing the Langoliers, and then we looked at how long it was, and it was like, yeah,
we will return to this, because one of the things is that this, when we sort of said, let's do like the terrible Stephen King adaptations, we just picked randomly. There are many, many, many more.
Oh, God.
We will come back.
There's 80 adaptations. 80.
And there's,
can you say that about any other writers? Dickens lists. Had that many adaptations?
No,
even?
I don't know. And there are ones you just, who knew? Some of them. It's just like, I don't remember that coming out. It's like, no one does.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of stuff. I was reading the list this morning. There was a whole bunch of stuff from the mid-90s, which I just have absolutely no idea even existed. So I have even less intention of watching now, I'll be completely honest with you.
We've picked a few. It ranges from the mid-80s right up to fairly recently. So there's a nice spread. And there was no quality control. We just went with...
We have some, gone straight in.
Some bad films that we wanted to talk about. And I think it's interesting, you coming at it as a non-King fan and me as a sort of an old-school King fan, I think it'll be interesting to see what we make of them. Because we haven't talked about them, our responses to them.
No, we haven't.
So we watched them and we've been
quite subtle with this, yeah. So what's the first film then?
Okay, so we're going to start with 1984's Children of the Corn.
Every child is afraid of the dark, the unknown, the nightmare. In Gatlin, Nebraska, that nightmare is in the corn. Stephen King's Children of the Corn.
What do you think?
This was the hardest one for me, I'll be honest. I love the premise.
Yes.
I love the premise, and I love the first 5 minutes as well. Yes. I love the bit where the kids are killing, you know, it's your classic kids run amok, kill off the
adults.
It's
an evil kids story.
Evil kids story. It's very similar to that that Spanish film, Who Could Kill a Child. It's got a very similar sort of vibe to that.
Yeah.
You know, two people out driving... Peter Horton is one of the guys
from 30 something.
From 30 something, plays Bert, and the lovely Linda Hamilton.
Oh, she's at her peak.
At her peak,
yeah.
That woman's jaw is transfixing.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
So I really enjoyed the first 5 minutes. And you know, they wash up in this like town
backwater.
Where are all the adults?
Yeah.
Why are all the kids dressed like it's the 19th century? And this is a weird one because premise wise, this is right up my alley. It's got a folk horror vibe to it. It's got a cosmic horror vibe to it. It's very Lovecraftian. You know, all the kids worship this, was it He Who Walks Behind the Rose?
Yes.
It's lovely. I love that. It's such a great sentence. You know, there's some good performances in it.
Mm-hmm.
I love the guy that plays the Isaac, the main John Franklin, who was actually, I think he was 24 when he made this.
Yes, so he's got some sort of condition that makes him look like a kid, basically.
It should be the one that has the most atmosphere, but it kind of squanders it.
It does.
It sets itself up really well, and then it just sort of turns into a bit of a car chase. It's not the only one we're going to be talking about today that has an inappropriate car chase that goes on for ages. But it never quite lit fire for me. There's a sort of blankness to the whole thing.
Yeah.
The director, Fritz Kirch, I think it's pronounced, he pretty much didn't do anything else
It's interesting. It's one of those films that I saw it, I think I was too scared to watch it as a kid, and I ended up watching it coming down off something when I was a teenager, and I remember it really kind of being like, oh, this is like really gnarly. And then I rewatched it and I was like, it's really not gnarly, it's quite weird and boring and flat. The flatness is a real thing. And as you say, so it's based on one of his Night Shift short stories. So he's written, the other great thing is that if you do want a Stephen King experience, you've got to read the short story collections. And he has chucked out a bunch of them. They get progressively less interesting. The first one, Night Shift, was I think 78. It was quite early on. That's great, and so many of the best Stephen King stuff has come from those short stories.
Yeah.
And then Skeleton Crew is the next one that he put out, and that is also full of great ideas. I think The Mist is in Skeleton Crew.
I love that. Yeah.
So Children of the Corn is just a tight, nasty little kind of short story. You can see why someone thought, you know...
I get the sense that in the short story there's a reveal...
Yeah.
And the film kind of squanders that reveal by kind of telling you what's going on as soon as these two strangers turn up in the town. Like, immediately, these spooky kids are like, oh, yeah, there's a reason we're doing this.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, I don't think I want to hang around for another hour while I wait to see how this plays out.
It really does. It is the one of all of these where you go, this could be remade as a really good film.
Absolutely.
With tons of atmosphere, applying just a bit more kind of, a bit more Wicker Man and a bit less kind of, car chasey TV movie sort of tropes. And I don't want everything to be fucking the Wicker Man, don't get me wrong, but you just need that sense of what the fuck is up with this place.
It is bizarrely, considering the setting they've got, it's peculiarly unatmospheric.
Yes.
It's one of those things, like, you know, as a sort of lesson to directors out there, it doesn't matter how many times you point your camera at some corn, you're not going to make that corn look particularly scary unless you do something interesting. Yeah. It's actually quite interesting seeing it as a contrast with In the Tall Grass, which is the one that Netflix, which is the Joe Hill and Stephen King adaptation.
And that was the guy, Vincent
Natalia, who did The Cube.
Yes.
It was quite interesting seeing that, you know, both films based around the subtle metaphor of cornfields. And when you looked at what Vincent Natalia did with how he filmed the corn and how he moved the camera around it, just instantly, not a great movie, but instantly had so much more going
got
for
some
it.
Good, was like, a good sense of disorientation of being lost in the corn. I think that's really well done.
And it sort of struck me that that would be the most obvious thing to do with this story, and the director just kind of doesn't do it.
No.
He seems to, every time you think he's going to put his foot down, he kind of seems to take his foot off the gas a little bit. So it's, I'm sure these were deliberate decisions. I'm sure he was trying to do something, but it never quite clicked for me.
Yeah, it's journeyman directing in the worst kind, and it squanders a decent atmospheric kind of idea
and a good cast. You know, I think the guy that plays Malachi, who is it, I've got it written down. Is it Courtney Gales? Who's the guy? Same guy that plays Hans Klopek in The Burbs.
Oh right,
it's the same
of
guy.
Of course it is.
Because you look, and he's got this extraordinary
beakish face,
sort of beakish kind of ginger physiognomy. Repellently violent.
Yeah, and it's like, he's the kind of older kid enforcer, isn't he? Yeah.
And I was just like, every time they threatened to do something really cool with him, they just kind of didn't.
Yeah.
And it was like,
he just looks like someone's annoying older brother suddenly. Yeah.
So it just became this kind of chase.
Yeah.
And I'm cool with movies consisting of nothing but chases.
Yeah.
Down with that. But it sacrificed all the kind of atmosphere that I got the sense it was trying to build up. And it has one of the most bizarrely sudden endings.
Yes.
Like, there's a kid in the back of the car. Hit her with the car door. The end.
Yeah.
Let's go off.
The budget is over.
Yeah. But they literally, like, him and her and the other two kids just walk off going,
yeah.
It's like the end of fucking Thundercats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, it's really, really odd.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some little bits, you know, like the bit where she gets crucified on the giant corn and there's the blue man, who's obviously the local law enforcement official that crucified. It's like, that's pretty cool. But they didn't do anything to introduce the law enforcement official in the first place. So when you've got this sort of skeleton with a cop's hat on and it kind of goes, you're like, oh, it's a cop. Oh, okay, right,
Yeah.
It literally takes a couple of seconds for it to hit, which is not what you want in a horror film.
There's a whole load of beats that it just completely misses. I do remember it was one of those ones that was quite satisfyingly gory, as in it's sort of, by modern standards, it doesn't particularly, you know, we're used to extreme gru now as a routine thing. I mean, any Alexandra Aja film has so much more fucking blood in it than this would.
And this is another place where a remake would probably be really much more fun, you know.
But I do remember, like, you know, as a kid, sort of seeing sort of stills from it and being like, oh, that looks gory and nasty. And there is something like enjoyably cheap about the fact that he's not the Wicker Man, the fact that he is this cheap, shitty kind of straight to video.
There is a bit where, when the kids murder the adults in the first scene, there is a bit where a guy, an older gentleman, is getting his hand put into a meat slicer, and it cuts away to a little boy's face, and the most pathetic speckle of blood hits him just underneath the eye. Like, come on, that should be
a Sam Raimi style.
There should be bits of bone showering his 8-year-old in the face. Mm. So obviously, you know, the lack of sort of overt gore is always going to be a bit of a markdown for me. But also, it's like the scene just kind of happens, and then it's like, and boom, now we're in, and it's kind of this thing where it's like 3 years later, and it's like, okay, so these kids have now been living in isolation for 3 years. None of them appear to have grown up. How are they living? What's going on? And I don't usually ask questions like this about films.
No, but
why not just go 3 weeks later?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's full of these little inconsistencies. Like, there's even bits when you're watching it where, like, hang on, their car was there. How come their car's there now?
Yeah.
These little bits where you're like, I think this is just quite lazy directing, actually.
Yeah.
I think there's a little bit of, like, a lack of knowledge of where characters are.
Yeah, there's no sense of geography. Yeah.
And like, they just hide in a barn for ages, despite the fact there's a load of kids right outside. It's like, well, they're not looking in the barn? So they're just hanging around on the street corners? It's it just gives it this feeling of flatness, because it stops it having any kind of sense of effect. Yeah.
And you're right in that it does that thing as well of going, the most shocking scene is in the first 5 minutes. Yeah. Now, on some level, you can see why you do that. It's kind of attention getting. Hmm. But you've immediately given away what the kind of the threat is. It's evil kids.
Yeah.
Now, that's an odd one, because as you say, where do you go from there? Unless you're going to ramp things up to just insane levels of people punching kids in the face, which, you know,
I was disappointed the lack of kids getting run over.
Yeah,
I thought thought we were going to get a lot more see of some that.
Yeah,
we'll see more of that later.
Yeah, but yeah, no, it's not great. It's not great. It's genuine schlock. And not in the fun way that you want schlock to be.
I think it's taking itself a little bit too seriously. Yeah. It you do get the sense that if someone was, like I say, just put the foot down on the gas and just have a little bit more of a yahoo with it, it would be a bit more fun. I liked the visualisation of the presence at the end. I'm a big sucker for the sort of over solarized presences in the air and like, you know, the sort of the body moving through between the cornrows is kind of fun. But again, you just sort of see it a bit, and then it just kind of goes away. So you're left. It's like, oh, that was cool. Do something with it.
Yeah.
Oh, you haven't.
It's interesting.
And it's just a consistent film of like every 10 minutes. You're like, yeah. Oh.
Yeah. It's actually just a bit flaccid, really, in the rewatch. And it's interesting. We talked about Clive Barker in a previous episode, and actually, this feels a bit like it could be a Clive Barker story.
Definitely got
and
that
if it
vibe.
Was a Clive Barker story, it'd be fucking great.
Yes, it would be amazing, because the kids would all be having sex with each other.
Absolutely.
While they were crucified. And yeah, I mean, that would just instantly put it a bit more in my ballpark, I'm honest. You know.
So moving on from that ignoble start, what have we got next?
Coming up next, 1988's Stephen King directed Maximum Overdrive.
Hi. My name is Stephen King. I've written several motion pictures. But I want to tell you about a movie called Maximum Overdrive, which is the first one I've directed.
Wow.
What in the dickens is going on around here?
A lot of people have directed Stephen King novels and stories. And I finally decided if you want something done right, you ought to do it yourself.
Here we go.
Fucking hell, this film.
Yeah.
This is a big sandwich, this movie. This is a big sandwich.
Yes.
There's a lot to discuss here. Do you like trucks? Because if you like trucks, and more specifically, do you like trucks going into things quite slowly?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of that. Now, famously, Stephen King was absolutely out of his fucking nuts when he directed this. This is the only attempt he's ever
this
made.
This is his one and only directed film. I mean, it's interesting, of the films we're talking about, his involvement is varying. Like, you know, he had no involvement in Children of the Corn,
no.
But he has provided scripts for some of the other ones. So, you know, and
not necessarily
said,
the best ones.
No,
he's provided some scripts for some right stinkers.
As we've talked about before, his involvement is never a guarantee that it's going to be any worse or better than you know, something he's had zero to do with. But this is his baby through and through. And it's not, I mean, it's based on a short story, Trucks, which I think is from Skeleton Crew. Mm.
Which has been adapted again, hasn't
it?
Yeah,
weirdly again.
Like the TV
unsuccessfully
adaptation.
Again.
Yeah.
And it's a great story. It's really bleak, the story. It's one of his nice little apocalyptic things. It asks you to just switch your brain off and say, something happens that makes all the trucks kind of rebel, essentially.
Yeah.
And that's a typical Stephen King thing, is just like, switch your brain off, don't ask about the science. It's just something supernatural.
What if trucks, but evil?
Yeah.
It's a bit like Black Mirror.
And in this is like Black Mirror, like this episode. But Maximum Overdrive takes that further. It's not just trucks, it's all appliances as well.
And all appliances, a big load of cocaine, and a constant AC/DC soundtrack throughout the entire thing.
Yeah.
Which, the weird thing about this film is, you're like, okay, giant trucks that kill everybody. One of them's got a giant green goblin mask on the front of it. Emilio Estevez is his youngest and most irritating, which is how he's absolutely
best. He's a proper punk.
Yeah. this, white shirted, cigarettes rolled up in the sleeve. AC/DC soundtrack throughout the entire thing. Why is it boring?
I know, and this is the
thing. Why is this film boring, Dan?
And again, if you just take the first 10 minutes of this film,
the bit on the construction, the bit on the bridge is fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
Because it asks this very real question, which I've always been interested to see. What if a load of people were on a dividing bridge, and it started dividing. And you get a good answer. Yeah. Lots of melons go everywhere. and people roll down and go, what the fuck, man?
Yeah.
In like exaggerated American accents. And things fall off it. People fall over in slow motion.
Yeah.
He loves his slow motion.
Oh, yeah.
He loves his
and
slow motion.
And that is a sign of a director who doesn't know what he's doing.
And a sign of a director who's done a lot of coke as well.
Yeah.
There's like kind of like, yeah, my slow motion, man. There's so many great bits in this film.
Yeah.
But I think one of the fundamental problems with it is that, like, and this will probably come across better when it's written, big trucks aren't that fast.
No. Yeah.
So you do constantly get this thing when it's like, oh no, there's a truck coming at 20 miles an hour. It should be, you know, and there's loads of those situations where people are running away from trucks and you're going, run left. Yeah. Or just run right. Just running directly in front of it because it's going to get you eventually.
You're not a pheasant on a country lane.
Yeah. You know? So, I mean, you know, first 10 minutes, a kid gets run over by a steamroller.
Yep.
Very, very happy
A Coke
that.
Machine yep. goes insane and fires Coke cans at Boy Scouts.
And hits Coach in the balls. That is awesome.
So this is... So what it has going for it, Maximum Overdrive, is it's got a genuine sort of gnarly violence for violence sake, knowingly trashy vibe. And you can tell, to his credit, King was not trying to do anything other than he described it as a kind of cheeseburger.
I think he called it a meathead movie.
Yeah, and he has meathead tendencies.
Yeah,
King. He's resolutely lowbrow. He's always got a chip on his shoulder about academia and, you know, respect of the art world.
As successful writers have a tendency,
especially
to do,
ones who he is a working class kid who, you know, came from a broken home and, you know, was clearly bullied and has all sorts of you know, stuff to work through and whatever, totally absent father, etc., etc. But you know, it is a knowingly trashy film. It is fun because of its ambitions to just be, you know, that kind of midnight movie style thing. Mm. But as you say, the fatal problem is because he's such a bad director, he doesn't know what he's doing. It drags. It is a short film that somehow feels really long.
Yeah.
And for years and years, I was like, yeah, I love that movie. And what I realised is I watched maybe the first half when it was on Channel 4 late at night. And I don't think I even knew it was a Stephen King thing. I think I just, you know, when you just kind of turned over and something's on. So I think I turned over right at the start where all the shit's going down. And I remember, you know, I was just at that age where I didn't really know what was what. And it seemed like a kind of almost like a bit of an outlaw thing. It's like, what is this fucking super violent, horrid, cruel movie? And it does have like a load of fun gore in it. I mean, it's a gory movie.
Yeah.
Everyone is an asshole. There's some hilarious...
Oh, Pat Hingle in
Pat
this
Hingle.
Film is just the biggest dick.
Yeah. And also Stephen King...
Commissioner Gordon, as you said. We love Pat Hingle. Yeah,
Stephen King loves his kind of main localized slang that he rolls out in everything as though everyone talks like they're a Maine farmer.
Yeah.
And so there's a bit where like Pat Hingle keeps talking about, you know, horse pucky. Like, horse pucky. Like everyone else says horse shit, but he's like horse pucky.
Pat Hingle, who is also, we should point out, sitting on a massive arsenal of weapons.
Yeah.
Where he's literally, there is a rocket launcher in the basement of this diner that they're all trapped in, and loads of assault rifles.
Yeah.
Which, in a way that's never really explained. I mean, I suppose we're meant to think that he's a survivalist or something.
So
but that's never really talked about. It's
like
just
Tremors,
there's a bunch of guns at the bottom.
It's something like Tremors, which is everything that Maximum Overdrive should be and isn't, you know, a genuinely fun, creative, low budget, you know, super knowing but also just super entertaining B movie. You know, they've got survivalists in that and they address it like these are the gun nuts who fucking are waiting for the apocalypse and they are ready.
And they do it in the stuff as well, don't they? Do you know what I mean? It's like,
and it gives you your old Romero is always doing it. He's finding reasons to go, now they can all get out the high kind of caliber weaponry and start fucking blowing shit up. But in this, it, as you say, it just is like, wait a minute, why has he got a fucking rocket launcher?
Yeah.
He just owns a diner.
Yeah.
And because narratively it's all over the place, you know, it is a film that is completely out of his grasp. You can see him.
He makes a fatal mistake of, rather than sticking with the people in the diner, he cuts between, because there's a kid that's escaping from the softball game at
that's
the beginning.
That's right, yeah.
And the people who sit in the diner. And the kid's trying to get to the diner, but he makes the fatal mistake of cutting between the two strands of action in a really irregular fashion.
Yeah, what it
fashion.
Should be is like a Assault on Precinct 13 with trucks, essentially.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, you get your kind of you know, because it all happens because a meteor goes over. Yeah. And I have no problem with that. I don't
down
mind
with that.
Someone going, a meteor, and it's got that classic thing where there's like news reports, the meteor has seen, blah, 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 and then everything starts kicking
and
off.
It's got that lovely green sky as well, and yeah, that's a good visual.
Like, there are some, there is a ton to enjoy. It's just, it should be like the guilty pleasure that is, you know, you'll pull it out and, you know, this is an entertaining watch. And if you haven't seen Maximum Overdrive, let me stick it on, you're going to love it. It just isn't, unfortunately. Yeah,
it should be a great midnight movie.
Yeah.
And, you can see that he's trying to make one, but you're right, he's not a good enough director.
Yeah.
And I think it's proven by the fact he never did it again. I think he realised he'd bitten off more than he could chew.
He notoriously did have a horrible time. And by all accounts, I think I've read an oral history of the making of Maximum Overdrive. And the crew, members of the crew and stuff are talking about it, and they're like, yeah, he just was having a bad time.
Yeah.
And I believe he was probably... allegedly, nose deep in the cocaine.
I think he's admitted that much. I mean, it's a cokey film. It's got all those sorts of like indulgences, which it just does over and over again because the guy on coke is going, that was brilliant the first time, let's do it again.
Yeah.
It's like being trapped with someone on coke telling you the same story over and over again.
And whereas Tony Scott is a cocaine director who can, because of his background in advertising and knowing how to just put visuals together to tell a story, not, you know, that someone like Tony Scott is an artist in how he does it, but he's fundamentally knows how to tell a story. It's why his films are so watchable. Well, terrible.
Maximum Overdrive by Tony Scott would be a fucking great movie.
Absolutely,
that would be everything that this film wants to be and isn't. I mean, it's just that really weird thing where I said, how does it feel? You know, as a metaler, I should talk a little bit about the AC/DC soundtrack.
Is it an original score, or do they just license a few?
They're basically, I think AC/DC gave him permission to use anything he liked because he was a very big proselytizer for AC/DC.
Yeah, I mean, he is a rock and roll fan.
He likes AC/DC and the Ramones. Those are his two favourite bands. So this is the kind of headspace.
And terrible blues rock.
Mm.
I mean, that is his big
undoubtedly,
thing.
He's never heard a riff like that he doesn't like. But it's like... There's one bit in this movie where Emilio Estevez, for some reason, completely inexplicable, after they've been communicated with by the machine gods, Emilio Estevez says, oh, well, the trucks are asking to be refueled. And one person in the dining goes, well, why should we do that? Fuck them. I don't want to refuel these things. Yeah. They're evil. And Emilio Estevez goes, no, let's do it. And you're like, why? The guy in the diner's got a much better idea.
Let them all run out of fuel.
This is a much better idea. But yeah, and there's this one brilliant bit where, you know, Emilio Estevez in his little white shirt is just kind of like, you know, sweating. It's like, okay, let's refuel some trucks. And you get the dongs from Hell's Bells, and then it kicks in, and it's like, you know, the hairs on the back of my arms go off. The most exciting scene in this film is the scene where a load of people spend a whole day refueling some trucks. That's actually the most exciting thing. And you can tell, you know, Stephen King, the blue-collar man, is like, let's look at some blue-collar working
Let's see some good, honest work.
Some sweaty men wiping their foreheads as they refuel a load of trucks. Yeah. And you can totally tell that's his favourite scene to film. Very strange.
At the end of the short story Trucks, it's this bleak ending where basically they realise, I can't remember the detail, but they humanity essentially realises that they can't do anything about it, so that it ends with this kind of, you are now just here to feed the trucks, and it's just like, you know, when you die at the pump, the next guy has to come up and keep fueling, and it doesn't bear thinking about. It's dumb as a bag of hammers in some way, but it's suitably bleak. And for a short story, it's like, great, that's the end. It's like,
it's about something. So there's a workplace satire there,
a sort of, you know, a nod to where we're going in terms of this kind of consumption of fuel and our, you know, blah, 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 blah. But he obviously thinks, oh, I better put that in somehow. But as you say, then has to have it being part of a kind of plan to win.
Yeah.
But it makes no fucking sense.
Absolutely no sense whatsoever. But he gets to do a cool scene with the AC. Because like the AC/DC stuff, when they try using it as like incidental music, so that, you know, they're just doing something nondescript with AC/DC playing really quietly in the background. And you're like, okay, well, you should never listen to AC/DC quietly for one thing. Yeah. You know, and so just, so trying to use AC/DC as incidental music, you're onto a loser there.
Yeah.
It's just not going to work. So it's just full of these really bad decisions that just hobble it. It stops it getting putting its foot on the gas. And
exactly.
That's a more appropriate metaphor in this respect.
No, it's a shame because it knows it wants to be fun. It's almost really fun, and yet it's fatally, massively dull as well. And that is a problem. I mean, I would say I would still probably watch it.
Oh, yeah.
But I would always have the same experience.
Yeah, where inevitably, I'm going to be drunk in about 10 years' time, and I'll go, come on, this will be fun, I'll just be asleep
halfway through.
You know?
Somehow the time will stretch out of this 90-minute movie.
It does feel long, you know. Yeah, it's episodic. And it sort of sets this thing up as well, doesn't it, where it goes... It actually says in the crawl at the beginning, it says kind of...
Because this is a film that has a crawl.
It has a crawl, yeah. On every level. It sort of says in the crawl at the beginning, it says kind of like, you know, we will be in the comet's tail for 8 days. And there's a bit where the girl that Emilio Estevez is just having sex with at every available opportunity, as you probably would in that sort of situation.
Emilio Estevez, let's be honest.
Absolutely. But there is this bit where the girl goes, so yeah, basically, you know, we just have to wait this out for 8 days. And as a viewer, you're just like, oh, God, please, no. Not eight days.
In real time. Yeah.
I want trucks for the immersive experience where I'm just, like, getting bored.
Waiting around in a diner, No
one even gets that drunk in the diner either. I was surprised there wasn't a scene of mass drunkenness.
No, and it's interesting as well because as a sort of concept, he's returned to that again. You know, the mist, everyone's trapped in a supermarket. And the mist is a great story and one of the best adaptations.
And he does hint at that in Matt's movie. He hints that the characters might start falling out for reasons of religion and for reasons of, you know, fundamental ideology. But he doesn't deliver on it because he just wants to show you more trucks.
Exactly. He's like a kid in the... It's a horrible cliche, but he really is like a kid in the candy shop. He's like, I just want to do all the stuff I've always wanted to do and see in a movie. Someone like Frank Darabont, much steadier kind of understanding of narrative and tension and all that stuff, just obviously turned a blinder with a much better kind of core text as well to work from. There's much more flesh there. But yeah, I mean, it squanders a great idea. There's nothing about... Like, I do not have a problem with things being dumb. And I don't... Like, someone like Larry Cohen is a great example of... Saint Larry Cohen, patron saint of the podcast.
Indeed.
R.I.P. You know, I don't... He's a great sort of person at going, here's an idea. It's a high concept. It's great. Don't think about it too much. I'm going to turn it around and I'm going to find some really fucking weird and interesting things to say with it. But also, it'll be really entertaining. Mm. But don't think about it too much. Because if you think about it too much, it'll fall apart. Yeah. And he just goes with it. And he's, you know, and that's what you need with this. You need that kind of steady understanding that, yes, it's a dumb idea. We don't need to worry about why it's happening. We just need to be so entertained by it. And King wants to do that. But because he's just not good enough, he doesn't. It's not good enough writing, and it's not good enough directing. Mm. And what it's most interesting for is just a monument to cocaine.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. I mean, I imagine he was paying everyone in cocaine. Because by the looks of Estevez, he's probably been added a couple of toots.
I
imagine Pat Hingle has been writing.
Hingle is like delivering. I mean. That's one of the pleasures of Hingle's performance, is completely off the scale, scenery chewing.
He pulls the whole thing up by its bootstraps, doesn't he? Watching Commissioner Gordon toting a rocket launcher and smoking a cigar is genuinely quite fantastic.
But
these decisions, like having that one of the characters is like, there's this honeymooning couple, and the female of the honeymooning couple is just so annoying. In a way that you can imagine on paper, like, oh God, she's the comic relief, she's going to be hilarious. It's like, no, she's profoundly irritating.
Yeah, it's just great.
You constantly want her to get run over. Yep. And she doesn't. Yeah, because the body count amongst people in the cafe is shockingly low.
Yeah, it kind of has
a load of people can come out of it and you're like, who the fuck is that guy? You don't even recognise them. Do you know what I mean? There's been no coverage of most of the characters.
Yeah, it has a really, really bloody ex. I mean, one of the things that is actually really kind of common theme in these terrible films that we watched is that they almost all of them have a really strong 10-minute start where you're like, this is going to be loads of fun, and the, you know, the body count in the first 10 minutes is enormous, and then it just slows right down, and you know, bar the bit where the machine gun on the back of the Jeep goes wild,
that's fun. Yeah,
I like some good squibs in that.
I liked the sentient machine gun,
yeah.
And I liked the crazed waitress woman who at every opportunity just throws herself in front of the machine gun until someone pulls her away from it until eventually it does manage to get shot, and you're like, oh, thank God!
Yeah. No, that's a fun bit, but
it's just a bit of a missed opportunity. And I would, and again, much like Children of the Corn, I think I would like to see a remake of it.
Yeah.
I'd like to see someone really go at it. You know?
I feel it's locked in. There's a sort of time and place that is. It's such an 80s experience.
Yeah.
It's an 80s idea. It's meant to be watched on telly at late at night, catching it on, you know, surfing through channels. It's not something you would sort of go, oh, I'm going to stream it, watch it. You know, it's there's something about it that it feels very locked into the 80s. That you know, it would, if someone did it now, there would be too much skill and knowingness. I know what you mean, but I sort of feel like it's...
It would just basically be The Mist.
Yeah,
I think they would basically be better, it would be The Mist with automated vehicles. Yeah. Which, let's face it, I'm not sure anyone really
Michael
needs
Bay's The Mist.
That's what we're looking at. Oh, my word. Yeah. You see, I didn't know I wanted that, but now you've said it, I actually kind of do.
So, having moved on from Stephen King's finest hour as a creator,
yeah,
what's next in our list?
The next film is the astonishing and not at all dated Lawnmower Man from 1992.
Dad, I have different games. I even have one that could help make you smarter.
Now, Job Smith is about to enter the world of virtual reality.
Ah, it's gonna hit me!
No, Job, just relax.
It's gonna be like being up there with the stars, Job. They're going to another planet.
His mind is like a clean, hungry sponge.
Oh my God, this film.
Did you watch this when it came out?
I did, yes.
Yeah. So this, just to give it a bit of context, this was the first 15 films. So for any American listeners, if there are any, you know, our rating system was and remains, I think, you know, Universal, PG, 15, 12, well, 12
yep.
which came in with Batman,
yep.
15, 18, and I think there used to be X, but, you know, that so that's kind of... 15,
18 is kind of what X was.
15 was your kind of gateway fun. Meant there would be some violence, some swearing,
I had a feeling,
some nudity, maybe.
I had a feeling this might have been 12 on video as well,
possibly.
Which is why my parents let me
watch
it.
Yeah,
they weren't in the habit of getting 15s out for me when I was 12.
So this was the first 15 I went to the cinema to see.
Oh, so halcyon days.
I went to see it in 1992. I was 15, exactly. It was like one of those kind of like, I can go in. And so I was going to like it, and I did like it.
Yes.
And I came out and I was like, that was good. It had amazing special effects. It had some tits in it.
Yep.
It had some violence in it.
Yep.
And it was amazing.
Yes.
And I loved it. And yep. And that was where I was with Lawnmower Man for years. I didn't watch it again for, I think, till probably last night or whatever it was,
yep.
and I watched it.
Yeah,
I knew it was shit. I knew that I was like, no, that my reading at 15 is wrong, but that is where it remained in my brain.
Absolutely.
It's like,
same.
It's an amazing
yeah.
film.
Yeah. Yeah. me and my brother were fucking blown away by this movie.
Yeah.
The state of the art at the time, use of virtual reality effects.
So
and the open again the amazing opening crawl where it's just like, by the year 2000 there will be a virtual reality headset in every house in the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's
sadly that didn't happen.
Amazing. Yeah, it's amazing for so many reasons. How did you find this watching it?
I loved it. Actually, do you know what? I had a fucking great time.
It was
this
a huge
film.
Amount of
I
fun.
I was not
it?
Expecting to. I was expecting that this one, out of all of them, would be the one where I was like, oh man, this looks really poor now. But actually, I thought it looked fucking great.
Well, the aesthetic has come all the way around
the way
to
around.
Looking quite fucking cool.
Well, we're in a post-vaporwave world
now.
So those sort of like, those 92 era sort of like bubbly startup graphics actually have now been re-aesthetized.
Yeah, it's like
you know?
An orb video or something.
Oh, it's very like one of those when you used to come home from raves in the mid-90s and someone would put on that thing and it would have like, you know,
the rave VHS.
Yeah, and it would have like, yeah, it's this sort of dragonfly creature flying over kind of poorly rendered landscapes while some, you know, System 7 played over the top of it. So actually, like, nowadays, that stuff actually looks quite cool. And it does do some pretty interesting stuff with it.
Yes.
You know, like Jeff Fahey, who plays the... who, I mean, let's have a word about it. I mean, there's some incredible performances in this film.
So
let's start
first
with
of all,
there,
yeah, it is a film that is stacked full of great performances.
Yeah.
And Jeff Fahey, I was fascinated by him because he is a kind of straight-to-video hero of sorts. Seemed to be in quite a few films I watched, you know, as a youth. Haven't seen him recently.
No, for some reason, no.
It is... So the concept of this is it's about a mentally challenged...
I think we can use the term simpleton.
I mean, I would want to say retard because that is kind of how it is
That's
played.
How it's portrayed, yeah.
Like, it's not a word I would use, but it's the word that should be used in terms of the depiction of this character.
If we're in the 19th century, cretin.
I mean, it is and astonishing.
He wears fucking dungarees. He spends the whole first half, 20 minutes of his film wearing dungarees. Going, oh, I don't know, Professor. He's like, literally, the only thing's missing is he hasn't got a sheaf of corn sticking out of his mouth.
Yeah. And he's you know, Jafar, he's actually like quite a jacked and I guess sort of handsome dude in his way. He's kind of blue-eyed, a bit creepy, but, you know, he's definitely kind of got a decent body and like so, and played kind of romantic leads in seedy body horror films of the 80s.
He's popped up in quite a few TV
programs.
He
spends the first, 10 or 15 minutes of this crossing his eyes.
And playing with the local kids. He loves comic books and computer games.
He's got the wonderful thing of being like, he's just such an innocent.
Yes.
It's astonishing.
It's like you would not, it would not fly now.
God. Should also bear in mind, so much about this film that wouldn't fly.
None of this is Stephen King's fault. He had his name taken off
this is the
this
one
film,
that he has the least to do with. And Lawnmower Man is a story from 1975. It has fuck all to do with what is kind of comes
There's
out.
There's no virtual reality in it.
And as far as I'm aware, the director and writer of this, Brett Matthews.
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
Brett Matthews, I think his name is.
Brett Leonard.
Brett Leonard, yeah. That's it. Brett Leonard basically kind of, I think, essentially wrote a film and then they sort of went, oh, for no money we could make this Stephen King.
Originally the script was called The Cyber God.
Which is a much...
That's a much better title.
It's more appropriate. I think Lawnmower Man is... It's talking things that have aged well. Lawnmower Man has a certain quality to that title, which is there's something a bit unknowable about it.
Yeah.
And it works better that it's like, what the fuck is Lawnmower Man? And when you watch it, it's like, you didn't think it was going to be this, did you? So, yes. So Fahey is in there.
Yeah. And actually, I love like Fahey's transformation, where he basically, due to the powers of virtual reality, he goes from being this simpleton to being a super hunk when he buys a pair of Levi's, which are expressly shot so you can see the tag.
Oh,
and it's like, there you go, he's got Levi's on now, and he's stopped wearing dungarees, and he's just ripped. He's absolutely jacked.
I have to say, when he kind of reveals his body suddenly, I was actually a little bit like, that is a good body.
That is a hell of a
There's
body.
A lot of like defined muscle work there that kind of, I was like, he looks like a superhero.
That
basically.
Brother keeps it tight.
It's good. And he's got buns of steel.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, in this film, which has myriad pleasures, he commits to his role.
It's a good
He commits to the simpleton role.
Yeah.
And he commits to the kind of evolution, the gradual change. I mean, it's a film that doesn't give it much space. I mean, he's you know, he wants to get to the good stuff, so he's like, and then he gets smarter, and then he has sex, and
apparently
then he's
apparently
like,
the director's cut, there's a bit more of the change, but I don't think I need to see
no
that,
you don't
to
need to
honest.
but Fahey's like, he's there, he's that he is a good B-movie actor because he fucking goes for it,
yeah,
and that is what you need in a film as dumb as this, you know.
And of course the other performance that elevates this
astonishing
film is Pierce Brosnan.
Let's
just take a minute to talk about Pierce Brosnan. We're talking a lot about men's appearances in this film. Let's just take a minute. Right, for a start, anyone, and this goes for anyone, even if you're listening to this, anyone who wears elasticated side Chelsea boots with those caterpillar soles on them can fucking do one. They are one of the worst fashion atrocities of all time. If you pair that with a pair of cargo shorts and an open button-down shirt, then you've basically committed three crimes against fashion in one go. Add to that a chest wig that looks like Yggdrasil, the Norse tree of life.
An earring,
an amazing earring.
Yep.
And hair that looks like it's come out of the Play-Doh hair factory. Like, it literally... Pierce Brosnan's, it looks like his head is excreting an oil slick down the back of his neck. He is just so physically weird in this
film. Sweaty. He's draining.
He's pre-Bond as well, so he's doing all those great Brosnan sort of...
there's loads of...
His opening line, which I've written down here, which is just one of my favourite lines. Screw the political arsehole. Political arseholes. He's the best chimp I've ever had.
Let's just note that this film starts with a chimp wearing a VR headset going on a gun rampage, where a lot of that sequence is... Chimp cam,
yeah. It's a chimp massacre from the perspective of the chimp.
I mean,
it's like there are so many choices made in this film, and I bet you anything Brosnan chose his own wardrobe.
Oh, I
you really
certainly
do get the vibe.
And again,
I'm not wearing that. I'm putting this on. This is what I wear around the house. If I was a professor,
this is my oatmeal cardigan. And he's, you know, he in true dum-dum Hollywood movie fashion, he is a scientist.
He, of course he's a scientist.
Of course he's a scientist.
And Dan, he's also a scientist working from an evil military-industrial complex. Yes,
called, I think it's called Virtual States, or Virtual... It's got a really, like, they're a secret organisation, and their name is literally what they do.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe call yourself something else.
Yeah.
Just call yourself something nebulous and unknown.
Yeah. Nope.
He is... the least convincing scientist since Mark Wahlberg in Transformers.
He, and also one of the worst ones. He spends the entire time drunk smoking.
Yeah, he's introduced smoking in bed. And it's funny, I sort of remember thinking that was acceptable, but, you know, in this, I was like, you absolute cunt. Yeah. Your wife is asleep.
So you're literally suffering here.
Just literally wakes up, can't sleep, so he sparks up and then pokes her awake and it's just like breathing smoke.
I need to tell you about what I'm doing with some monkeys.
I mean, he is, again, like Fahey, he commits 100% into
but this
film.
This is the great thing. Like Bond, Rob does, as one of the great grunting actors of our time. Because I watch Mamma Mia and, like, you know, you know, like, pre-Bond, he was one of the great grunters.
Yep.
And post-Bond, he was a much smoother experience. And yet, Dan, you look at that, look at the poster of Mamma Mia. Just close in on Pierce Brosnan's face. Those are cold, dead eyes.
Oh, he's an amazing,
cold, dead eyes. Yeah. And you know what? He misses the grunting.
He does.
He wants to go back to being a full-time grunt actor.
Yeah, he should be... you know, he's got that thing that Goldblum has. And Goldblum has managed to traffic this into being somehow... like a universally accepted brand of oddball charm. But, you know, early Goldblum performances are full of just weird hand gestures and odd enunciations, sweaty, estranged, bug-eyed performances. And Bronholm is doing that in his early career. I mean, he turns up in the Long Goodbye as a kind of a sexy IRA killer. But yeah, no. Once he hits his mid-80s period, I mean, he's a wonderful ham, and I mean, he's always been a ham.
Mm.
But this hamminess is totally delectable. I mean, the more I'm talking about Lawnmower Man, the more I'm convinced it's actually just a 5 out of 5 experience.
Yeah. Oh, I was not bored for a single second.
No, and it cracks along.
Yeah.
It cracks along. And add in the fact that you've got, like, this incredibly dated but kind of funky VR thing, which was where all the money went, you know. Because apart from that, it's just... literally a suburban drama with a simpleton becoming a sentient cyber god in Bronson's shed.
By playing Wipeout, or what looks like Wipeout.
Yeah, yeah. And it's and it actually builds to a crescendo that I think the end is actually kind of good.
I dug it.
Yeah.
I love the bit where Jeff Fahey's giant gold VR face appears in front of a bunch of people and darts its eyes around in that really weird way that, like, VR stuff does. It's a stationary face. Its eyes just sort of go donk, donk, donk.
Yeah, no, but it's quite unsettling.
It looks unsettling, you know, and a giant gold face appearing in front of you. And I was like, that's pretty cool.
It's
actually,
interesting.
You know?
So there's a bit in a Grant Morrison comic from the... early 90s called Sebastian O. Sebastian O is the high concept is essentially a sort of science fiction what if Oscar Wilde was a sort of genre hero, really.
Yeah.
And it's a kind of Victorian steampunk sci-fi thing, but it's not steampunk. Crucially, it's not steampunk. Yeah. I mean, I'd say that, but it's not. Anyway, the point is it's got this oddball sort of VR period VR thing, and basically the main baddie essentially says at one point, you know, how you'll know when I've kind of taken over reality, because I'll make it rain on demand or whatever.
Mm.
And at the end of it, when you think you've defeated him, you know, lo and behold, it starts raining exactly at the time he said it would start raining, and it's like, oh, that's nice. That's the fucking end of Lawnmower Man.
Yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, it's exactly.
I'm pretty sure. I don't know which came out first.
Lawnmower Man came out first.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, because I think Sebastian O is 93. So
I think it might be later than that.
I'm going to call Grant Morrison, was like, I like the end of Lawnmower Man. I imagine he went to see Lawnmower Man and had a lot of fun with it and nicked the end.
You know what? I think everyone did. I think, like, one of the great things about, like, watching these movies has being able to go back and, like, look at the amount of archive, because like things like the New Yorker and the Roger Ebert website, they've got all the original reviews for these things archived, so you can read them. And Lawnmower Man, it's one of those things where you're reading it and every single reviewer is just kind of like, oh, this is just boring, cheap, because the language to deal with that kind of B-movie stuff didn't really exist in broadsheets back then.
And this was a film, let's not forget, that, you know, while everything about it screams straight to video, and now would be on the Sci-Fi Channel for sure, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
This was released in cinema. I went to see it at my local fucking Odeon or the ABC.
It was a big deal.
It was a big deal. It was a massive hit, you know.
I remember, like...
When I say it was a massive hit,
I think it did quite well.
It did pretty good. It's certainly enough to spawn a sequel, which I have not seen.
No.
Lawnmower Man 2 Beyond Cyberspace.
Oh, good God.
Which I don't know what happens beyond cyberspace.
My mind breaks in half. It was a fairly big hit. I mean, I remember seeing articles about it on John Craven's News Round when they were talking about how incredible the special effects were.
Well, this is the thing that is worth also taking note of. Unlike most of the films we're talking about, which, you know, something like Maximum Overdrive is a retro, you know, even at the time it was a kind of retrograde kind of, you know, attempt to sort of do a cheesy B movie. Lawnmower Man was seen as the cutting edge.
Mm.
And the special effects, you know, I mean, I know it came out the same year as Terminator 2, or maybe even the year after. So, you know, it's not to say that we hadn't seen someone sort of proving what could be done with these computer effects in an actually artistic and genuinely groundbreaking way. But the stuff in Lawnmower Man at the time was just not commonly seen.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
and it was, as you say, it was kind of seen as like, this is the future. This is what films will look like in the future.
I was a big computer games fan around the time this came out. Mm. You know, I would buy, you know, Computer and Video Games magazine every month, religiously. And there were loads of articles about VR all the time. There was always updates on, like, what was happening with the latest technology. When are we going to be able to get it in our home? And it was basically, you know, it was quite a long time after Lawnmower Man came out. Certainly 5 years or so. When people actually realised the tech isn't good enough.
No.
This is actually a bit of a non-starter. So a lot of, you know, Californian startup groups probably died very ignominiously. Yeah. But it was at the time, you know, this was considered a groundbreaking cyber thriller. And the idea that, you know, of a virtual world which you could go into and there being risks involved was new.
Yeah.
And I think we're only beginning to see now that there are risks involved in living in virtual worlds.
Well, that's the other thing, is that in its kind of, whilst it misses... It's not prescient in so many ways, and it misses where the focus will be. In the same way that someone like William Gibson opens up and says, you know, like, I didn't quite see, I kind of almost got it right, but I missed actually where things would go, you know. So if you look at, you know, his work, it's like he sees some things very clearly, but it didn't quite pan out that way. It went a different way, and, you know, and actually... Yeah, it's kind of clumsy and it's obvious and it's kind of lunkheaded in loads of ways. But it does have some stuff to say about, as you say, like this kind of virtual existence.
Someone lives almost entirely in a virtual world and turns into a massive arsehole. Do you know what I mean? Now, I think we've all seen that happening over the last few years. You've seen that happening if you've played World of Warcraft.
It's just, do you know what I mean? Yeah, it's like, just that this sees
the threat being... We're not all flying around, you know, sculpting our bodies into dragonflies and having sex with each other.
And talking of which, let's talk about the cyber sex sequence, which is really a genuinely great moment in film.
It's astonishing.
Yeah.
Like, no one's ever done it since because they wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
But it's like... because it's a 90s movie, every 90s movie has to have a sex scene.
Yeah.
As... anybody who was traumatised by watching The English Patient with their parents will bear out to you.
Well, when I, you know, watching this again this time, I was like, oh, I remember this. This is the bit where she gets her boobs out, because it was like, this is great. This is happening.
This is proper adult stuff.
But then it's like this kind of morphogenic sex sequence is genuinely like...
It's
pretty
wild.
Cool.
It's wild. It looks wild. Like,
and
you know,
the way they're
like,
kind of coming together as one and, like, you know, and going, pushing the boundaries of what you can do, and then she kind of breaks.
Yeah, breaks her mind by turning into a giant orifice beast.
Yes, I mean, that bit is fucking weird.
Yeah, that is like, I don't know.
I mean, it's actually quite a problematic sequence. Yeah. Again, that would not pass muster now, because it's essentially kind of rape sequence.
It's a mind rape, isn't it?
Yeah, it's done in a really amusing kind of cack-handed way, but nonetheless, it kind of left the nasty taste, actually. Yeah. I was like, this is quite unpleasant. And then when she's kind of like, you know, her mind's shot and she's kind of drooling on the bed afterwards, you're like, all right, okay, yeah, that's quite horrid, actually, yeah. You know.
Yeah, it's...
And she does not deserve that.
No, she's just a nice lady.
She just... And even... one of the bits I really like about it is that he's got this... Jeff Fahey has a kind of older mentor who's just this other guy who, you know... does that because he mows lawns, that's what he does.
He's also the most Irish man I've ever seen in film. There is even a bit
that character is the Stephen King character.
Oh yes,
he's straight out of Stephen King.
Yeah, there's even a bit where he goes, oh, you can actually hear the little people if you go near the grass. Where he says that,
but he's sort of
wow,
he says about her, like, because there's this whole idea, because she's kind of like this loose woman.
She's the sexy neighbour.
Yeah, sexy neighbour. But he just says...
Like one of the Diet Coke women.
You know, she lost her husband and now she just enjoys life, is kind of what he says. Mm. And I was like, that's actually quite a progressive way of looking at her. Because the film punishes her nonetheless for being like a wanton. But I quite liked that moment. I was like, yeah, fair enough. Yeah. She is. She's just having a good time. She's lost her husband. She likes to have sex with all the local stud muffins. Yeah. And that's why the fuck not?
So Pierce Brosnan ruins it for
ruins
everybody
everything.
By grunting.
Brosnan is the baddie in this film, which is really interesting.
100%.
As well.
Yeah. Like he's your main character, but he's also the person that insists on taking this poor simpleton gardener's mind and pushing it to breaking point until he suddenly realizes he's gone too far.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, it's My Fair Lady. But with cyber sex and like
My Fair Cyber God
and monkeys with VR headsets on. I mean, it's basically it's everything My Fair Lady should have been.
It's your regular Pygmalion. It's a genuinely. I had a great time.
Yeah, me too.
This.
I have to say,
I really enjoyed it.
It was the one that slipped out the easiest, probably. Well, no. The next one we're going to talk about is probably on a par with that, but. But no, I mean, Lawnmower Man was a lot of fun. It gets really slated and is really written off. Check it out. Yeah. It's honestly, even just from a visual perspective, it's way more interesting than a ton of similar kind of dodgy things that came out at that time, you know, bad cyber thrillers. It's actually just the one that kind of commits quite hard to its sort of psychedelic qualities. It is a psychedelic film.
Totally. It's a trip movie, yeah.
There were bits where I kind of was just like pausing it and looking at it going, if you just... cut this, put this shot somewhere and said, check this film out, people would now be like, oh, what's that? That looks really good.
Yeah.
It's a load of fun.
Yeah. I had a great time with this.
And one. Talking of fun.
Ah.
What's next?
Our next film, Dan, is 1992's Sleepwalkers.
Behind the secret is a hunger.
Does it have to be her?
And behind it all is the imagination of Stephen King.
Killed one of my men. He was scared of a cat.
Sleepwalkers.
I fucking love this film.
I loved it when I was a kid. I've loved it every single time I've watched it since.
I am so jealous of you seeing this when you were a kid.
Right.
I have only seen this as an adult, but I have seen it as an adult about four times.
Yeah.
So I think this film is just... It's so much fun.
So this is another, like Maximum Overdrive, this is an original, different from Maximum Overdrive. This has no basis in any short story.
I think
story.
It was a discarded short story.
Very probably, yeah.
I think it was an idea he had in the back of the drawer.
So Stephen King wrote the screenplay for this. So he bears full responsibility for it. But of course, the other man who bears responsibility is the director of Sleepwalkers, Mick Garris.
Where do we even begin with Mick?
Well, we've talked before about doing an all Mick podcast.
All Mick all night.
All Mick all night. Yeah.
24 hours of Garris.
Yeah, 24 hour live Garris podcast. Mick Garris is probably the man who has done the most Stephen King adaptations.
I think hands down, yeah.
He is someone who is clearly a friend of King's.
He's a friend of fucking everyone. They're all in this film.
He is the Zelig of horror.
Yeah.
He is a man who seems to have been involved in every key horror film somehow. Of the last 30 years, 40 years. Mm. He's one of the nicest humans ever, clearly.
Nice. He works for a company called Nice Guy Productions.
And he makes really bad films. But...
But I have yet to not be entertained by any of the
Jesus
ones I've
Jesus Christ.
Seen. Like, I mean, you know, let's be fair to the Gaz. He was responsible for Masters of Horror. He got all these great minds in a room together to sort of, like... And he gave them unlimited creative freedom in a way that...
And at the time, pretty much that was not
pretty much resuscitated the idea of looking at these horror guys as serious contenders still.
Yeah.
And this idea of actually kind of prestige, high quality horror stuff on, you know, cable television. Now, I mean, Masters of Horror is a landmark in terms of where we are now with horror. And he is also responsible for The Stand, which is, I think you said...
I think it still holds the record as the most popular the most viewed miniseries of all time.
Yeah.
It was a huge phenomenon when that came out. I haven't seen it, I must confess.
You've never seen The Stand?
I've never seen The Stand. Wow, I've heard good things about it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It holds up. It shows that it's a TV miniseries from the late 80s. And it has a notorious damp squib ending, but fuck it, so does the book.
So does the book.
But it is a huge amount of fun, and he captures a lot of what's good about the book in the miniseries. Garris is a treat, let's be honest.
Well, we're huge fans of his podcast.
Yep.
We really want that to come back. It's still not on the air at the time of recording. And I want Mick Garris's... I want to hear more horror directors on the slab spilling their guts, literally.
Yes. Figuratively, I think you mean.
Yeah, I think you're fine, Nick.
So Sleepwalkers. Sleepwalkers is an astonishingly crass... You know, talk about a cheeseburger. This is a cheeseburger movie.
Yeah, it's a cheeseburger with some jelly in the middle.
It is what... So I remember renting this. It was kind of that period of my life where my Friday nights consisted of my mum and dad probably going out somewhere, me being allowed to rent a horror film of my choice, and at this point I was allowed to get 18s, I think, as long as it wasn't like, you know, something sexy, it was pretty much okay. I think my mum was all right with it, and I remember I would get I'd cook myself an oven pizza. I think I maybe was drinking at the time, so I might have like two cans of Stella as well.
Nice.
And I would sit and watch films like Point Break and, you know, all sorts of kind of crass action movies, great sort of fun things like that. And Sleepwalkers was one I got out, and I remember just being like, this is delivering on all fronts.
And I don't think I could disagree with that even now. Literally, I don't know how many fronts there are, but I get the feeling that there aren't any left unturned by this film.
No.
This film is a fucking roller coaster.
It really is.
I've seen it four times now. I never have any idea what this film is going to do next. No. It's still constantly surprising to me. So the basic plot is about a mother and son who are the last, I think, of a race of vampiric cat people.
Yes.
Who are also fucking.
Yes. In one of the most puzzling sort of focal points of a film is like, why?
Yes. Yeah. Why? I think maybe because they're the last. I don't...
Yeah.
Like, it's never explained, is
but
it?
It's, but the incest scenes are shot like soft porn.
Yeah.
Alice Krieg, who is his mum, is super hot.
Indeed.
And the tenderness of the incest scenes is genuinely transgressive.
Yeah. It still feels shocking watching it now. Like, I watched this with Lady Nuneaton Savage and our housemate, and that bit happened, and you could hear a pin drop in the room when everyone realised what was going to happen. And it was like, you know, I knew what was going to go on. I was like, how are people going to react to this? And the room just went fucking silent.
Yeah.
And everyone was just like, I did not see that coming. It's like, well, you really can't. How would you ever see that coming? It's like, why is this happening? Why is it in this film? I think, Stephen, we should have more incest.
Yeah.
Because this is King's fault.
Yes.
This is King's fault. He wrote the script for this. Yep. There's no one to blame for this other than King. And it's just one of the most puzzling swerves, which happens in the first 5 minutes as well. Because the son is introduced as this kind of like quarterbacky sensitive hunk.
Yeah,
isn't
he's the new boy in town.
Yeah.
So they arrive in a small town, classic sort of disruption narrative. They arrive in this small town, then he's the new kid in town, but he's totally like a hunk. He's like a dreamy quarterback type.
He looks a bit like Jeff Fahey, actually.
Yeah, he's got a blonde, sort of vibe. Hunky guy. And we're introduced to our heroine, Madchen Amick, the beautiful Madchen Amick of Twin Peaks fame. And she is kind of drawn into his world. And it just goes south so quickly. That's the thing I love about it.
But it goes south, east, northwest, north. It goes all around the map.
Yeah.
Like so fast, almost within a scene at points. Like, our introduction to what these characters can do is one of the truly one of the great opening sequences in cinema. Nonetheless, that Mark Hamill is playing the sheriff of the clearly of the town that they've just come from. And you see him walking around, oh, I don't know what's happened here. And he goes, I don't know, but they sure don't like cats. And then there's just a shot of this house with loads of dead cats just hanging from the rafters and stuff. And it's genuinely arresting.
Yep.
You know how upset horror fans get when you kill animals?
Yeah, personally, this film does this film, not hold
back. Whoa, doesn't give a shit about
cat
killing cats.
Mutilation,
yeah, it's really into it. And from that opening, you are just like, yeah, I have no idea where this film's going to go. Okay, incest. Okay, cool. Mm. Grave rubbing?
Yep.
What is that? Do people... it turns out that the Madkin Amick character's mum bonds with this new kid in town over the fact that they both like grave rubbing. Not grave robbing. They like going to graves with tracing paper and getting like charcoals. Yes. And then her mum puts them up on the wall. Does that not strike you as a little bit morbid? What would happen if a relative came along while you were doing that? It's going to put some flowers
down.
What the
fuck are you doing?
Yeah, sorry, I'm just rubbing the name of your dead relative so I can put it up on my fucking wall. Like, no one has ever done that, but that's a thing.
It's a thing that apparently two people like. And
two people who could have just, one of them has just moved from a completely different town.
Yeah.
And the mum's like really, really suggestive with it. It's like, do you use a hard stick or do you use powder? It's just like... And again... That's King.
Yeah.
That's on King.
Yeah.
Like, one of the interesting things about this film is, like, and I think about Garris as a director, is that you get the sense, like, you know, he's a very nice guy.
Oh, yeah.
And you really get the sense that if an actor or a writer or anyone comes up to him and goes, I've got this idea, why don't I try doing this? Garris will go, that's great, do it.
Let's do it.
Because nothing else will explain the cop character.
Yes. I mean, let's be honest, we could do a podcast just about this performance.
Just about him. I mean... I've got his name written down here. Dan Martin.
Yes.
He plays Officer Andy Simpson, who drives around with a cat on his front seat.
Yep.
Singing a song that I'm pretty sure isn't a real song.
No, I'm fairly sure that he is freestyling his whole dialogue.
Yeah.
I don't know that he is working from a script.
No.
Nothing he does or says or how he reacts is in any way like wed to this film.
I saw a man with a pecker in his hand. So get off the stage, you son of a bitch. It's like, what is this? And you know for a fact, Garris is like, oh, that's hilarious. Yeah. You should do that. Despite the fact it completely tonally unbalances the film.
He is astonishing. I don't know if he's an actor.
He's been in a few things, actually. He's been in a lot of TV work.
He's got a classic scenery chewing, you know, off the charts performance where it is genuinely awful. But also weirdly compelling and sort of makes you love the character because he's so odd. And he's such a goofy, non-heroic kind of figure to have as your heroic figure.
Well, he's presented as your central character, isn't he?
Yeah.
And there's scenes of him investigating where this strange family is coming from and, you know, why, you know, disturbances in the neighbourhood and stuff like that. And you're like, oh, okay, here's our guy. And then they just kill him.
Yeah, and that's one of the great moments in this film is that he's just taken off the map in a way where it's quite shocking.
Yeah.
You just don't see it coming. That you think, oh, okay, well, he's going to get hurt. No, he's out of it. And also, in that scene, the main character, the main kind of bad guy, the young son, sleepwalker type, he... also sort of tries to assault Madchen Emek really quite quickly.
Is that Brian Krause?
Brian Krause, that's it. And so she really quickly also realises that he is, you know, fucked up and evil.
Mm.
So you think it's going to be a slow burn where she's like, no, but not my lovely new boyfriend. But no, really quickly.
Well, he instantly becomes a different character.
Yeah.
So he goes from being this kind of like, oh, hey, I love rubbing graves. You know, let's hang around and have a picnic in a graveyard.
Mm.
Which is, let's face it, a strange choice for a first date.
Yeah.
And then instantly he goes from that, you know, his face transforms in a beautiful piece of CGI morphing.
Some great early CGI here.
Beautiful stuff. And then instantly he turns into this kind of wisecracking, guffawing evilman.
Yeah.
Like when he puts a pencil through our favourite cop's ear and goes, Cop Kebab! Like, it's like, where's this come from?
Yeah,
like,
I mean, it's completely wild, that bit. You also then get, I don't know if it's then or just prior to it, you get a great extended sequence where Garris gets all of his horror director buddies in for a really joyful...
it's just after he's killed the teacher.
That's right.
Mr. Phallus.
Yes.
The teacher's name is Mr. Phallus.
And you get, so you have John Landis, Toby Hooper, Joe Dante, Stephen King,
Clive Barker.
Clive Barker.
A young Clive Barker.
Yeah, and they all turn up in this, like, pretty much one...
John Landis as well.
Dante is actually the mortician.
Dante and Landis are in the mortuary, yeah.
And it's great because it's one of those things that as a kid, I was like, oh, I know who that is. I know. And even at, you know, even as at the time, you're like, something's up. Why are these people also, A, don't look like in anyone who's ever been in a film? Why their facial hair is so pronounced? But also, it's a real early... kind of Easter egg moment, and I remember like Quentin Tarantino kind of mocking this because he likes to do his references oh so subtly, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And this he was kind of mocking this kind of like, well, Detective Landis, and I remember thinking, no, that was great because as a kid who wasn't like a total fucking, you know, nerd and an obsessive nerd, I was just like, this is great. Oh, this is like, oh, they're all directors. I see.
Yeah.
So it's like you're kind of almost like elementary sort of postmodernism.
Well, it's also his first, you know, it's also this realization that you get where it's like Mick Garris knows fucking everybody.
Yeah, and that they're all friends. Yeah, and that's wonderful. Finding out that like Clive Barker and Toby Hooper and John Landis are all friends is great.
Yeah, it's very satisfying. Yeah.
But it's also a tremendous moment of like, it literally capsizes the film because you're like, what are all these people doing? Why are they suddenly in the film?
And again, it just demonstrates Garris's lack of tonal control.
Yeah.
You know, it is that thing where it's like, I'm just going to stop and have a bit of comedy. I'm going to stop and just introduce some of the Masters of Horror. I'm going to say, it's like, keep your film on the rails, Garris. Yep. There's a really long car chase in it for absolutely no reason, which ends when it transpires that these sleepwalkers can transform the make of the cars they drive by using psychic powers. So his car goes from like a blue Barracuda to like a red Mustang.
Yes,
which I'm like, that is an impressive.
So that's how he evades like, escape you at a capture at one point.
So you have much better ways of making money than you do hiding in a house, waiting to have sex with your mum and like steal Mag Kanamek. Like, why does he need Mag Kanamek? Is that ever explained?
There is a sort of, I think. I think it's she's meant to be the yeah, it's not clear, is it?
No.
Because it sets itself up like they need her.
He starts sucking some kind of blue light out of her mouth at some point.
Yeah.
But then it's never explained why.
And then you also have this thing that even though they're kind of werecats, vampiric werecats, they're also their main thing that they are, you know, afraid of, and the thing that can kill them is cats, which is again a bit weird.
It doesn't make any sense.
A werewolf and like the problem being dogs.
Yeah. When did Stephen King quit cocaine?
I don't know, but I would say he was still hitting it quite hard when he was writing this script.
It really comes across as a cokey script. I've had another idea, and another idea. And they're not all good.
And the other thing, that the one of the main reasons that Sleepwalker still holds up is at the time, I remember being like quite astonished at how gory it is. Mm. And it is still...
It's really gory.
Really gory.
Yeah,
and it's a really funny thing, because we talk about Children of the Corn, and Children of the Corn seemed gory, but actually it's pretty tame in reality. It's a bit trashy, but it's pretty tame. This is a really gory movie. Mm. Like, it's gloopy, it's really bloody,
yeah.
And it's all sort of squib, you know, effects. It's so it's got a kind of real physicality, the sort of slimy, bloody goriness of it. And it really goes for it. I mean, when people are killed, it's really quite sort of...
Ron Perlman turns up in this film, barks at everybody for half a scene. You're like, oh, here's a character. Gets killed off in the next scene, has his hand ripped off.
And
gets punched in the face with his own severed arm, I believe.
Again, I mean, you only need to say that to understand that this film either is or isn't for you.
Yeah.
I
mean, I haven't even got to the bit where someone gets stabbed in the back with a corn on the cob. After Alice Krieg has yelled, no vegetables, no dessert, she stabs a policeman to death with a corn on the cob, which by the looks of it went through his spine. I mean, that is just, I mean, but again, it's this thing where Garris is just clearly just kind of like, oh, that's a great idea. Let's do that. I don't care what kind of movie I'm making anymore. It's vastly odd.
It's vastly odd. It's tonally awful. It's all over the map. It's uncontrolled. It's inexplicable. And yet it is so much fun. Mm. And I was going to say, so you watched it with Lady in the Savage. Did she enjoy it?
She fucking loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had an absolute blast.
That is the thing. It's a film that is incredibly crass, full of deeply transgressive, weird moments. And yet it's sort of got like a total goofy joie de vivre.
It's charming.
That is just really, it's irrepressible is the word. It is like an absolute winner. In terms, you know, it's the kind of film that if you stumbled across it as a kid, like surfing the channels at night, you'd be like, what's this? And it go, oh, it's going to deliver in every way. And you would not forget it.
Yeah.
You would not forget that movie.
It's so weird. I mean, we haven't even mentioned the fact that the soundtrack is dominated by Enya. Fucking Enya.
It was 1992.
Yeah. But you know who he was originally... Garris talks, because he's a great raconteur, Garris. I mean, he tells the same five stories over and over again.
Oh, my God,
he tells them very well. Do you know who he was originally offered to? He was offered a certain band to use on the soundtrack for this. Nirvana.
Oh, the path not travelled. Oh,
can you imagine if Sleepwalkers had been soundtracked by Nirvana?
Fuck me. Jesus.
Just take a moment.
Actually taken my breath away.
Yeah, absolutely amazing, isn't it? And he was like, no, I don't think so.
Bleach era Nirvana.
No, I don't think so. I think this lovely Enya track.
Like Enya.
Yeah, and it's like, and so Enya keeps popping in for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Wow. I mean, he just drops it on the film from a great
needle
height.
Needle drops. Yeah.
And I mean, we haven't even talked about Clovis the attack cat, which is the one that a cat that police, because obviously they're terrified of cats. So there's a, luckily enough, when our favourite Jim Dandy singing police officer gets killed, a cat immediately jumps out the front window and attacks Brian Krause.
Absolutely.
Causing him to become mortally wounded.
Yes. I mean, that's him.
That's how he
fucked.
Dies. He spends the last third of a film on a sofa.
Oh,
unable
wow.
to breathe.
It's so good. And you know what? Talk about Quentin Tarantino. It's quite important to remember, this was made in 1992. I think Reservoir Dogs was made in 92. I think it actually finally got released in 93 or whatever. But you know, so just to place yourself of where we are in films, you're about to hit that kind of confident 90. You know, Do the Right Thing came out the same year as this.
And you could only be improved by Attack Cats.
Clovis the Attack Cat. But
you
know what I mean? Like, you actually, to get an idea of the landscape.
If Do the Right Thing had been soundtracked by Enya, that
we're talking
been a
about, you
film.
Know, it's not this film you watch and you think, oh, this must be from the 80s. It's like, no. This is from the early 90s. And it is completely bizarre to think of that this came out, you know, at a time when, like, indie cinema was exploding, all these interesting voices, and Garris is just going, yeah, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's a film out of time.
It really is.
It doesn't feel like a product of its time at all, and I couldn't tell you where this film feels like it would fit in, because I can't put it next to anything.
It's got that thing which people, it's an overused thing, but you know when people say, they never made them like this.
Yeah.
And this is one of those. Yeah. They never fucking made them like this. They haven't done it before and they haven't done it since. It's totally singular.
It's a perfect storm.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Stephen King, and again, if I'm being wrong here, please don't sue me. He's not very litigious, is he, Stephen King?
Nah, he's fine.
He's fine. You've got, this amazingly coked up script. You've got a director who seems to want to let all the actors do whatever the hell they like. Like, I bet the scene with Mag Kanemek dancing around to the Dirty Dancing soundtrack was completely her idea as well, because she liked Dirty Dancing.
Yep.
You really get that sense. And it's just, it's got a director with such a loose hands on the tiller that he's just letting it go all over the place. And it's like, it would be so much of a more boring,
and yet
straight
it
down
is,
the line
although
film.
Although it's like all of those things, it's not incoherent and it's not boring. And that is the thing. And that is because Garris actually does understand storytelling, putting things together. He does.
Yeah.
In his weird way, he does.
He's written enough. You know, he's written scripts, he's done everything. But there is a really goofy, uncontrolled sense of fun to this film, which I never, ever get bored of.
Like, no.
I could just watch it any time of the day.
It's a fucking treat.
Yeah.
And that brings us up to almost the present day.
Almost
the most recent.
2016.
Yeah, the most recent of the these abominations, which is Cell.
It's terrorists, right? It's got to be terrorists.
Don't use your cell phone.
We're going to survive. People are going to die.
You okay?
So yeah, this is a funny one, isn't it?
Yeah, this got released to little or no. It is incredibly badly reviewed, like most of these. But
it's I think it's at like 12%.
Yeah, it's incredibly low.
It's got an absolute shoo-in.
But this got a limited cinema release.
Mm-hmm.
After it had come out on VOD,
yeah.
As well, after it had come out already, I don't know what the planning, the reasoning was behind that. That's a very strange way to do things.
And it has, what's interesting about it is it's the second film, second Stephen King adaptation that has both John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson in it.
Yes, that's right.
Because 1408 came out, which is a more, people like that more. It's okay.
I wouldn't see that in the cinema. I thought it was pretty good.
It's okay. Yeah. And this is like, it's weird. It's like, here they are again.
Mm.
The weird things about this are Stephen King co-wrote this,
yep.
So he was heavily involved.
Yep.
John Cusack produced this, so it's clearly not just a... despite evidence to the contrary, it seems like something he was interested in, at least. And it is a humongous pile of shit.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
But there is things in it.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot in it. Maybe not what it intended to have in it that I found amusing in this. I mean, this is basically, so we're 2016, we are at peak zombie now. We are at absolute peak. I think Walking Dead started by this point.
We've had your Dawn of the Dead remake, Zack Snyder one as well in the can. Yeah.
And really weirdly, this seems like everyone involved was just like, well, not just let's jump on that bandwagon, but let's do this better than it's ever been done before. You cannot say this film is not ambitious.
No.
Like, it's really ambitious. Mm. It completely lacks the skill to realise its ambitions. The director is a guy called Todd Williams. He's the guy that made the second Paranormal Activity.
Who wrote it with? He wrote it with King. So he seems invested in it. Let's just say, it's based upon a Stephen King novel from his kind of comeback. So basically, what happened to Stephen King is he kind of went away from horror. He wrote his things like Dolores Claiborne and wrote Rose Madder and films like that, Bag of Bones, where he was kind of doing like gothic, trying to sort of do almost soap operatic gothic novels that were like less overtly supernatural, still fucking batshit, of course. He was then hit by a car and really, really, really badly fucking injured. Like, I mean, you know, he was laid up for ages. He nearly died. He, you know, multiple broken bones. He was completely, you know, he very nearly died. And in recuperation, he wrote Dreamcatcher, which is a film.
We are definitely going to get to Dreamcatcher.
Another time. And he Asterix. Then, so he then kind of, slowly but surely kind of got back on the writing, and he sort of was almost like, I think, kind of possibly getting towards retiring. He's always talked about retiring, and yet he has completely reneged on that.
He's
now.
incapable of retirement. He's a writing machine.
And so he then churned out a bunch of stuff in the 2000s, like Juma Key, Cell, The Regulators, Desperation, all these things. They all came out. I think actually Desperation's in the 90s, but Insomnia was 98. There's a whole slew of these.
He's written with both his sons as well, hasn't he?
Yeah. And in that kind of era, there was just a whole load of like pot boilers that are, you know, not fondly thought of by anyone. Cell is one of those. It's essentially a lame retread of The Stand, written with none of the conviction and none of the passion, and it's apparently completely half-baked, squanders an interesting premise and just does something, you know, retreads the same ground he's done before.
But also it's one of those things where it's got that sort of slightly on the nose hook where it's like, what if cell phones were evil? You know, so, you know, the basic idea being it's not a meteorite, it's not people biting you.
Yes, it's a signal
through your cell phone that turns you into
it's a bit like Garth Ennis's Crossed, really.
It's closer to that, isn't it?
Everyone becomes a sort of primitive, like savage zombie type, but they don't seem to eat people almost.
In the first scene of this film, someone does eat a dog.
I mean, so let's talk about this. So this started, I watched it, and 10 minutes in, I was 100% there for
absolutely
this film.
Absolutely on board, yeah.
It stars John Cusack as a graphic novelist, strike one. That's great.
Yeah. Right. Quick aside, have you ever met a single comics artist who describes himself as a graphic novelist? We do not. This is just a note for Hollywood, right? And a note for script writers everywhere. Comics writers do not use the term graphic novelists about themselves. They use the term comics writers. Graphic novel is a completely outdated, very much frowned upon term.
Yeah, yeah. So
you would never call yourself a graphic novelist. Mm.
you know what I mean? It's like calling myself. It's like me eyeing a keyboard and calling myself a conductor.
It starts off as well where John Cusack has just signed some like amazing deal.
Yeah, I think he's got a game out of
graphic
it, hasn't he?
Novel to be turned into all these like multi-platform things. So he's basically just hit pay dirt.
Yes.
So he's like kind of a tortured artist who's. But let's be honest, this is all sketched in the most like. Perfunctory way you've ever heard. I mean, it's a phone call to his wife where he's just like, honey, you're not going to believe it. They want to buy the whole thing and they want to do this, this, and this.
And then they want to turn it into a game, don't
they?
This
has never happened, not even to Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
So it starts from this premise. He is then at an airport waiting to get his flight back to see his wife, who he is estranged from, his wife and son. Again, not really addressed why or particularly, you know, what the motivations are, you know. But we get the sense that he needs to get home to make things good with his wife, you know, reconnect with his son and share that big, big, big comics loot that he's just fucking made up.
Who do you reckon that was? Do you reckon it was IDW Dynamite?
Probably.
Who do you reckon?
Boom Studios.
Boom Studios. Yeah, yeah. Top Cow. Really pumping the dollars out. Mm.
See, then at the airport, this kind of signal starts, you know, you get this kind of montage of how everybody uses their phone. Everyone's on their phone all the time.
One of the most
right?
bizarre title sequences I've ever seen. So, like, it's a montage of, like, people in an airport, all on their phones, because everyone's on their phones these days. Don't know if you've noticed yet. But the titles are displayed. There are these black bars
big
that come out of nowhere.
Bars with white writing.
With white writing in them. Which I was like...
But they obscure everything that you need to see.
I was like, I've never seen this before. Do I like this? I've never seen it before. And I was like, no, it's shit.
And
this
because
is a really poor artistic decision.
Because it is a montage of showing people using their phones. And routinely, you cannot see what they're doing because a huge black bar is in the way. And I was like, oh, is this meant to be that, you know, this is the kind of jamming signal of the cell phone? But I was like, but it doesn't matter because it means you can't see what's happening in this kind of... It's jarring and it puts you immediately on edge in the wrong way.
Yeah.
I'm glad you noticed that because I really was just like, this is terrible.
Yeah. It immediately sets you up for the fact that you're about to watch a film that makes really nothing but the wrong decisions. From beginning to end.
Apart from the scene where everyone starts to go mad, which is one of the great kind of 0-60 escalation sequences you've ever seen, because as you say, it kind of has people eating. There's a guy eating a dog, a woman getting her head smashed into a wall, a bloke punching a woman in the face repeatedly before John Cusack hits him with something and splits his skull open. I mean, this all happens in like 30 seconds.
It gets pretty visceral.
And it's, you know, you've had a little set-up shot of a chef with a big knife cutting stuff up and he's running around just impaling people. And, you know, I was just like, I am here for this because it was trashy, fun, exhilarating, and it just was like, oh right, we are in for a fucking trashy fun thrill ride. And then that is the best the film can muster.
Yeah
And what you then get is just a really torturous and weirdly slow road movie, kind of with Samuel L. Jackson as a train driver?
As a gay train driver.
He
very, very briefly says at the beginning, my man left me a while ago, so I don't have anyone I need to get back to.
Right.
So we instantly realise that he doesn't have to do anything, so he can just hang around with John Cusack.
He's a gay man, and he's lost his lover, so he won't have anything to do.
Yeah, no attachments. He must be really bored. and then they set off on this classic road movie. He's got to go back and find that his wife.
They pick up a sort of young girl.
Yes, you know,
they pick her
upstairs.
Up. I mean, she kind of joins the crew.
Yeah.
So and it is very much that kind of stand, like, you know, the survivors were making their way through this apocalyptic world. But it's the most flat experience. And, like, we have to talk about John Cusack in this film.
Oh, my word. Like, the mystery of John Cusack is something that I'm very surprised by. Now, Gross Point Blank is one of my favourite films of all time. And I remember when John Cusack could just open a motherfucking movie. Mm. And then something happened. And all of a sudden, he just wasn't in films anymore.
He
appeared in a bunch of stuff made for the Chinese market.
Right.
He's in that. There's this weird Great Wall of China movie with like him and a couple of Chinese actors in it. Like, and he seemed to do a bunch of stuff like that, but he just, almost overnight, he seemed to vanish from Hollywood.
Yeah,
from Maps of the Stars.
Which is a great
movie.
He is a curious persona. So he came out of the 80s. He was the oddball you know, you've got your Tom Cruise and your Christian Slaters and your sort of Emilio Estefez, and they all sort of perform variations on the kind of cocky young punk theme. And Cusack, you know, was in a couple of really great low budget fun weird films like Better Off Dead and One Crazy Summer. He's in The Sure Thing with Rob Reiner, which is a great movie, possibly aged a bit badly because it's the entire premise is about him on a road trip to have a sure thing where he gets to have sex with a hottie, so yeah, I'm not sure how much that hangs up. He then is in like the landmark kind of teen mope sort of proto, it's kind of proto grunge movie, Say Anything,
yeah,
which is sort of it kind of Cameron Crowe predates the kind of the coming kind of Imoto rock sort of 90s thing.
He's in one of the ultimate examples of films like that. He's in High Fidelity.
He's in High Fidelity.
And Gross Point Blank is very much an example of that.
Yeah.
Like, Gross Point Blank, he's playing the grown-up version of the character he was in Say Anything.
Yes, and Gross Point Blank is, like I say, it's a perfect movie. It uses John Cusack to perfection. It uses that off-putting, weird, slightly unknowable persona.
He's got this funny kind of slack-jawed charisma. Have you ever noticed? Like most of the time, his mouth is open. But you very rarely see actors who have their mouth open for most of the time.
If you pause their film with John Cusack again, there's a good chance he looks massively gormless in every kind of still
it's
shot.
It's a really odd sense of charisma that completely worked for him when he was in these movies as a sort of gormless teenager. But when he's older, it kind of makes him look a bit odd. And I think one of the reasons that maybe he hasn't had the sort of Hollywood career, I don't think he's had any work done.
Right.
You get the sense looking at him, I think maybe a bit on the cheekbones, but he doesn't
He's definitely got a lot of makeup on, but I'm not sure he's had...
His character in Maps of the Stars, obviously, is almost a joke because he's had so much done.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is maybe a sort of in-joke, but like he doesn't look like he's had much work done, so I don't know if maybe that's affected
The only thing that he clearly has had done is that he is clearly a bald man.
Oh, my word.
And
his hair in this film
is something else.
Like, you know, I mean, this is the weird thing.
Wild strands of crow-like hair flying off his head.
I was not expecting for Pierce Brosnan to have a challenger for weirdest haircut out of the five movies that we were talking about tonight. But I was watching it, like, I was just fascinated by Cusack's
hair. And
thankfully, he puts it under a bobble hat for a lot.
He's sort of dressed like a teenager. He's got like drainpipe jeans and a long black coat.
I think he's wearing a Gogo Bordello t-shirt.
Yeah, and he definitely is. And again, I feel like he dressed himself for this movie.
Oh, he always wears t-shirts of bands he likes. He's a massive music nerd.
Yeah. And at one point he's wearing a sort of beanie hat, you know, really odd. I mean, it's a hugely odd performance. I feel like he was challenging kind of late stage Nick Cage, and perhaps that is an area that he might end up in, actually.
I would hope so.
Fully commits to the weirdness in the way that Cage has done.
Yeah.
There is some sort of scope for him, because this is a borderline great weird performance, and yet somewhere the whole film just kind of flatlines, and he just starts to look utterly bored.
Yeah,
in it. Samuel L. Jackson, I mean, talk about phoning it in. He's just he's barely acting. He kind of just goes from the film at one point, and you don't notice that he's gone. And you know, I love Samuel L. Jackson. I have no problems with him, and he's a guy who can resuscitate a bad film with a lively performance. And
if Samuel L. Jackson gives a shit, then you've got a film on your hands.
And in this, he clearly doesn't give a shit. No one gives a shit. But
he is one of those actors who's never met a paycheck he didn't like. Isn't
sure,
he, Samuel Jackson.
He likes to work. He turns up in a lot of bad movies.
Yeah.
And yet, like, what's odd is, as we were saying, that there is that the director clearly does give a shit.
Yeah.
The John Cusack is a producer, you know, so it should be a sort of weird passion project, and yet it just doesn't feel like it. It feels utterly inert, and it just chugs along, and like I say, it becomes a very pallid sort of stand rip-off.
Well, it keeps threatening to do stuff that's interesting. So you're like, oh, it's a zombie
Stacey
movie.
Stacey Keach turns up.
In
for about 5 minutes.
Munches through some scenery and then promptly gets killed by an exploding car. It's always nice to see
having set fire to a huge field of sleeping zombies.
That was actually one of the best bits one of the best bits about the film, when John Cusack and Samuel Jackson are driving a giant truck full of petrol over a giant field full of dead bodies while swigging from a cherry decanter before setting it all on fire. That was fun.
Yeah.
So there's bits of this film where I'm like, it keeps having ideas and then doing nothing with them. Like, the, you know, so it turns out that all of the people are dreaming about the same person.
Yes.
Who is a person that...
Raggedy Man.
Yes, who is a person that... he's called the Raggedy Man in the original book. In the film, he's just called the King of the Internet. Which is just like, fucking hell. Did you get like 5 minutes into the script? Oh, fuck it. King of the Internet.
Yeah, yeah.
Really bad. And so it turns out that they're all dreaming about the same person. You're like, that's interesting. Don't do anything.
And that this is the John Cusack's character has, his whole graphic novel is about this character. Yep. And the only reason we know this is because Samuel Jackson goes, it's the guy, you know, you've been drawing in your comic or whatever.
Graphic novel. Okay.
And the reason he has to say that is because we get a glimpse around John Cusack's apartment. We see all the drawings, and it is not clear that he's been drawing this guy. Yeah. So they fuck that up completely.
Completely,
So you have to have Samuel L. Jackson actually say it because it's not clear.
Mm.
And that is also done nothing with. They don't do anything with that idea. It just is that there is this figure. A classic kind of king, baddie, like Randall Flagg in The Stand and the Dark Tower sequence, which I haven't read and refuse to.
With you on that,
you know, it just doesn't do anything with that at all, and then it's sort of just you're introduced to some more characters,
but it keeps threatening to have good ideas. Like the idea is that the zombies become more adaptable, so they start being able to transmit the disease by singing this signal to each other. There's bits where they sort of keep themselves alive by transmit, and what they're transmitting is that. Do you remember that troll song thing? I got a la 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 that was like a big hit on the internet about like 10 years ago. I didn't realise this. Lady and Uneaten Sandwich had to show me this, and it's like this footage of this weird Russian guy kind of miming this kind of fa la 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 song, and it's like that's interesting. Oh, you haven't done anything with it.
Yeah.
So it keeps having these sort of... It keeps hinting at having ideas bigger than
and this is 2016, so there's a ton of stuff about memes and, you know, that it could be doing. Because this is the other idea. The cell phone is, you know, I think the book came out in, like, the early 2000s. So the idea of cell phones was... And even then it was half-baked. But by 2016, it's like, I mean, cell phones is one thing, but everyone can fucking... access everything on their phone. So
and also by that point everyone's texting. People aren't actually talking to each other on the phone.
So it's dated already in its kind of depiction of this society. And as you say, it doesn't do anything with the ideas that it has. And it kind of culminates in a kind of bait and switch ending, which is sort of like a classic, you know, you think he's saved the day, but it turns out he hasn't. And that final shot of all of these zombie people sort of walking in a circle,
trudging
round a phone mast, almost.
And they don't make them walk. They make them do a sort of weird half jog thing, which just looks utterly comical.
And yet that moment is almost quite captivating as a final shot. And especially because it starts playing
You'll Never Walk Alone.
And so again,
it's a recording of people at Anfield singing it. So immediately I'm taken out of this. I'm thinking about Liverpool Football Club having just won the Premier League.
Or you're thinking it's about to go into the Pink Floyd song, you know.
Yeah,
Anyway, the one off Medal. But you know, so, you know, sort of should be quite a powerful ending. And yet it just comes at this, you know, the pace of it, the whole where you've got to, why you're there, just doesn't mean anything. And I was just left completely bemused by what I'd watched.
It's this bizarre episodic nature as well, where it's like, you know, that they meet survivors on the road. The survivors, and indeed in one case, one of the dead families, again with this king thing, they seem to manage to uncover an arsenal of weapons very, very quickly.
Oh, and but the broad strokes characters that they meet, the kind of, they go to this kind of bar where there's this kind of like, almost like lounge sort of couple. They're sort of like, they're something out of, they're kind of time locked kind of couple of, you know.
Now they walk into a bar from like 1950.
Yeah, and it just sits so oddly. She's got like a beehive hairdo, and you know.
And for some reason, the guy is talking out of one of those throat things, isn't he?
But it just isn't addressed at all.
Which I was like, oh, they're going to do something interesting with the technology, because he's talking through this thing, and it's a receiver.
It's going to start talking.
It's like, nope, didn't do anything with that.
Yeah, and the whole thing has a really muted. Like, it's a very cheap film.
It's appallingly edited. Like, it is so badly edited.
What I liked about it, in a way, or wanted to like about it, is that, as you say, it's ambitious as all hell. And it wants to go for this epic kind of, you know, it gets around that by just using very bad CGI of mass crowds and things. And then the whole thing has that hazy, grey, black thing where bad effects are being kind of covered up by muting the whole filter of the whole look of the film.
It constantly looks like it's drizzling.
Yeah, and yeah. It has no like visual panache at all. I mean, it is just a slog in every sense of the word. Mm. But what a curious thing, you know, like there's part of me that wants to like it for its sort of oddball ambition.
I went in, you know, and it's a film that's been slagged off a lot, and I always go in wanting to like films.
Yeah, anything that's at 12%,
like that. Yeah, come on, it's got to have something. This must have pissed some people off. Yeah, it's got to have something over it. But yeah, it's just curiously muted. Like I say, the editing is really bad. If you look at the fundamental blocks of cinema that it uses, it's constantly like bits of the soundtrack are overlaying from one scene into another. You constantly can't tell where the characters are meant to be at any one time. Like the bit where the zombies get into the bar is just absolutely atrocious.
It's almost incomprehensible what happens there. Like, it's so odd. It's just, yeah. It's a film that makes you feel like you're falling asleep and waking up and missing things, but you're not.
You're not. <It's> not. Which is ironic for us, because that's something we're constantly doing.
Yeah, that's how I watch most films now. Again, like a real testament to like the odd way in which kind of these half-baked terrible Stephen King things get greenlit into half-baked terrible movies,
or occasionally half-baked brilliant ones.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's the thing, you know, we've talked about five films now. They are literally all, maybe not all across the map in terms of quality, but all across the map in terms of enjoyment.
Yeah,
you know what I mean, and
genre. What each one of those is kind of doing is like, so there's a ton of different ideas being thrown around, but it is really like someone firing shit at a wall. I mean, it just is like, I don't know, maybe this is a thing, you know. It harks back to what we were saying, that it's actually, these films are terrible objectively and subjectively, but also some of them very enjoyable. But that is a very key part of Stephen King.
Yeah,
he is not a high quality creator. You know, he's an interesting creator, he's capable of great writing, he's written some of the most iconic and, you know, in, I don't know, like films that have just, films and books that have completely got under the psyche and skin of millions of people, and yet it's just absolute crazy nonsense. It really is, some of it. Something like Cell is just, you know, if you didn't know that had anything to do with Stephen King, you'd be like, yeah, I mean, this is just some garbage sort of bad film that someone's come up with. It's like, no, he wrote the fucking script.
Yeah.
He signed off fully on this. He probably rates this higher than The Shining in terms of cinematic experiences, you know.
Yeah, so it's the Stephen King crapshoot.
Yeah.
You just never quite know what you're going to get when you get one of his books adapted. And, like, you know, we're talking about ranging in quality from, you know, and obviously his books range in quality, but yeah, we're talking about ranging in quality from The Shining, like even the Doctor Sleep, the latest one, you know, as a solid adaptation. So we're talking about this sort of high prestige stuff all the way down to your Children of the Corn, all the way down to something that's just a total mess, but really fun, like Sleepwalkers. There's no, there's an authorial voice, but there's no consistent quality. And from what I gather, because I haven't read any, that's also a problem with the books.
It's 100%. I mean, this is the thing, is I think that you cannot basically cherry pick your Stephen King adaptations to try and pretend that he is something he's not by going, if we're just going to talk about, you know, the high character, The Dead Zone, Carrie, The Shining, and say, oh, yeah, Misery, this is Stephen King. It's like, no, there is Stephen King, but this is also Stephen King.
Yeah.
And you cannot, these are the kind of ugly, unwanted stepchildren who live in the basement.
The Malachis, the red-headed stepchildren.
And you've got to sort of take those if you want to get your head around who this man is and what his kind of legacy is. It's this legacy of deep weirdness.
Yeah.
And the only thing I'd say is that what none of these films are is pedestrian slasher movies, tedious psychological thrillers. They're not, you know, they're not haunted house movies. Or if they are, they're fucking weird ones. You know, there is a goofball energy to Stephen King's work that comes through in these films, and it makes you want to like them.
Yeah.
Even though fully know that what you're not going to get is some sort of high quality, decent horror movie, or something that, like what you were talking about earlier, this idea of kind of avant-garde cosmic kind of unsettling, alienating horror. That's not what you're going to get.
Yeah.
This is weird, weird fast food made by someone who just cannot stop producing.
Yeah, you know? It's the Stephen King crapshoot, you know. And I'm along for the ride, man. Along for the ride. I'm going to keep watching these movies.
Yeah, and I think that as we've said, this is definitely part one.
Oh God, yeah, we're coming.
There's more to.
There is practically a bottomless well to be scraped.
Like I say, 80 adaptations. There's plenty.
We'll be here. You can guys go off and have a bite. We'll be back here talking about it.
We'll be watching these things just so you don't have to.
Which should be the tagline for this show.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, and that's probably a good place to draw a line under this latest episode of The Savage Beast.
Yeah, this has been fun.
Yeah, it has. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you again.
Take it easy, guys.
But in your own personal life, are there things that you are actually afraid of? Because you certainly make people afraid of their dogs, their cars, their trucks, their cats.
Well, I'm afraid of trucks.